This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age podcast featuring the Sarcastic Four, Episode 3, 1964.
I think the greatest contribution I made in comics is the fact that I helped to build up readership. I think people have accepted me, they accepted my stories, because I think they recognize their own values in those stories.
Place to Be Nation Pop, welcome back. Welcome to the third episode of the Marvel Age podcast. We are here today to cover all things 1964 in Marvel history. With me, as always, and I, of course, am your host, Nick Duke. I didn't say that, but not that you care who I am. You care more about our panelists. Our panelists, who are, of course, the West Coast contingent, Todd Weber. Todd, how are you this fine evening?
Nick Duke, I'm doing spectacularly well. It's an amazing day. I'm feeling fantastic.
And sarcastic, I would hope.
We'll see about that.
We'll see about that. All right. What about Mr. Tim Capel?
Dick Nuke, I consumed several potions last night. I think I have only just recently reverted to human form again today. Yes. So I think our timing is good, and we should be able to do this. Looking forward to it.
Well, hopefully you can work some of those toxins out of your body throughout the course of this podcast. We'll see if we can help you with that. And of course, the final member of our panel, Mr. Russell Sellers. Russell, how are you doing this fine, undetermined evening?
I'm doing better because I am placing toxins in my body as we do this. So, this is going to be a lot of fun.
And that's a great opportunity to throw a little shout out to Monday Night Brewing in the great city and state of Atlanta, Georgia, for their Dr. Robot Sour that they have out right now that I am enjoying one of currently. Swig a beer for the working man. But in any event, we are, of course, the Marvel Age podcast, here to provide you with a year-by-year breakdown of Marvel's entire publishing history, or at least the high points of the Marvel Universe continuity anyway. We hope you have listened to the first two episodes of our show, covering November of 61 through the end of 1962, and of course covering 1963. We also hope you have listened to our sister show, Marvel Age Masterclass with Ben Morris. Which, of course, is his reaction show to our show. His first two episodes are also out. His first episode had the esteemed Russell Sellers. His second episode, which just came out not too long ago as we record this, featured Mr. Tim Capel. So all those Marvel Age goodies are out there in the Place to Be Nation Pop archives for those of you who are looking to catch up. But with all that being said, guys, let's go ahead and dive right into it. Here we are getting ready for 1964, and as we've opened the first two shows, we'll open it once more with kind of talking about what you guys were expecting to get out of this year's reading list. What were you most looking forward to, and was there anything maybe that you were dreading diving into? Tim, let's start with you.
Well, as far as what I was dreading, we're going to get out of the way first, so that's somewhat fortunate, because it's all kind of a smooth sailing from here once we get past this first little hump. In terms of the year as a whole, I think I looked at 64 as kind of a stabilizing year, in that we didn't have that whole slew of first appearances and origins. And I mean, yes, there are still some notables here, you know, two in particular, one debut, one re-debut, that are a pretty big deal, but you don't have just issue after issue devoted to that kind of thing. So that's sort of what I was looking to get out of the year, and just seeing how things were falling into place with this universe that's now, you know, almost not quite 3 years old.
Yeah, I was kind of in the same boat. You know, like you said, a lot of the first, you know, 2 years was a whole lot of setup, and it feels like now coming into 64, a lot of the pieces are on the board. And you can start to have some more interplay. Yes, there have been crossovers prior to this. I mean, you've had the Avengers, you've had the Fantastic Four meeting the Hulk, and you've had big crossovers like that. But this is kind of where I was starting to expect some of the more casual crossovers, where things are referenced in such a fashion that it's just, you know, an openly acknowledged thing that we're in a shared universe now, rather than making a big, huge deal out of it. And we do get a little bit of that, particularly in an annual issue that I'm looking forward to talking about. Todd, what were you looking forward to, or maybe not looking forward to, coming into this year?
This year is all about, at least looking at it from a big meta perspective, the return of a certain character who will return in Avengers number 4, which we'll get to in a couple moments here.
Russell, what about you?
Yep, that.
Well, like Tim, I was certainly not looking forward to any more Tales of Suspense. The less I have to read of that, the better. I gotta say, I wasn't really looking forward to more Avengers either after our last go around with that. But the more Amazing Spider-Man, Journey into Mystery, and of course Strange Tales I could get, the better. And the back half of our list is actually loaded with that. But I got actually pleasantly surprised by a couple of issues I was not expecting to enjoy, and wound up kind of loving.
Yeah, I mean, I myself was hoping for more Journey into Mystery on this year's reading list. It's kind of disappointing to me that over, in our last two episodes, we've only really looked at one Journey into Mystery issue, and of course, this year, and we'll dive into that a little bit. But much like you guys, one thing of, you know, one aspect of this reading list that I had actually read before, and that I was not looking forward to revisiting at all, is going to be the first item for discussion on this week's episode. That, of course, being Tales of Suspense. And Tales of Suspense, as we touched on in our episode for 1963, was the book that is most known for introducing us to Tony Stark, a.k.a. Iron Man. And while we had varying opinions on the quality of Tales of Suspense 39 in 1963, I don't think we're going to have many varying opinions on the Tales of Suspense 50, 54 through 55, and 57, which are the four issues we read. 50, 54, and 55, let's talk about those first, because they all kind of tie together, because they, for better or for worse, I think we all have to agree at this point, historically introduced and set up Iron Man's most frequent recurring villain, that of course being the Mandarin. And we came down pretty hard on Tales of Suspense 39 for having some very negative, you know, offensive racial stereotypes and portrayals of Asian characters. But this, guys, I thought was Tales of Suspense 39 on steroids in that regard. It was, I could overlook elements of it in 39 because I was so impressed by the tension of the story and some of the pacing and the way the story was put together. There's no way to overlook this. This is cringeworthy. It might be, it's right there with the Ant-Man stuff in terms of the absolute dirt worst of this project thus far. Russell, I know you're chomping at the bit to tear this apart.
Can we just say, holy shit, that racism, though? And yes, that is a pun. If you go read the issue, you will say,
very good.
Holy shit. Oh, yep. It is. It beats you about the head and neck area with how just utterly dumb this is. The backwards level thinking of the 1960s is on full display here. But not only that, but there's a moment where they start talking about the Mandarin and some of his other folks being like experts and like using karate blows. And all I wanted to do was scream at them, karate is Japanese, you fucking idiots. And well, we are in nowhere near Japan.
Stan Lee thought Asia was a country, not a continent featuring different cultures and things. So,
also Pat Morita was Japanese, not Chinese, and there is no famous Chinaman category.
Also, there's a moment where a certain character chops himself into a coma, which is just a truly, truly batshit moment for this book, as if you didn't think it could get any lower. But it's not only that.
Was his name Todd Weber at age 15?
Hot take. We're going to go there. But there are also moments in America where it's like, my God, not only is this racist as hell, but the misogyny on display is disgusting.
It's bad, but that's one thing we'll talk about throughout the course of this episode. That seems like that's kind of par for the course in 1964 Marvel, does it not?
It's not just Tales of Suspense.
No, it's not. I think it's awful here.
I think Tales of Suspense wins the award for it, though, because of the way Pepper Potts is written. I mean, Jesus, this is like Mad Men, but without the social commentary of it. This is holding it up as something to be admired, or at best, the norm.
This would not pass the Bedshell test if it were.
No. If this were
put because there's only one woman in the book, so there's no
way to
qualify.
This is. And then again, Happy Hogan is also written basically as Ben Grimm. This awkward as fuck love triangle that is just not working. Basically, nothing about this classic Iron Man stuff is working for me. I find it dreadful, and I'm only going to keep tearing it apart as we go.
Okay, here's where I'll disagree with you a little bit. I mean, looking past all the tremendously racist stuff, which I'm sure Tim and Todd have plenty to say about, I really can't add anything on that front other than, good God, it's awful. And while the love triangle specifically doesn't work for me, I actually kind of enjoyed the Happy Hogan bits in these issues because I found myself reading Happy Hogan as Otis from Superman the movie. And for that reason, just like the looks on his face, he looked like Ned Beatty. That's who he looked like.
I read him as Barney Rubble.
Barney Rubble, okay.
Whatever you say, Mr. Stark.
Or Dino Bravo, whichever.
Dino Bravo.
But, yeah, I kind of dug the Happy Hogan stuff. Like, I think there's the one issue where Stark puts him in charge of all the production of Stark Industries just to keep him away from Pepper while he's out of town, essentially, and, like, he runs the company into the ground over the course of like 3 days. And it's cool to see those little scenes of like his exasperation and stuff. I don't know. I dug that. Had a very like Eeyore feel to it almost.
And so help me out here. Happy's gimmick is that he never smiles, right?
He has a permanent sad face, scowl. Why they call him Happy.
And it's ironically named Happy. I mean, my grandfather was named Harold. And his nickname in the service and as a Chevron employee, because he owned his own station, was Happy Hal because he was a dick. So Happy Hogan is not rest in peace, Grandpa. But you know, as a profession, that was your gimmick. So Happy Hogan is not a dick. He's just a grump, you know, and kind of a simpleton. And what's with his cauliflower ears?
Right. Here's the thing. I wrote down that he has vaguely human features.
His ears are so bad he could fight Kimbo Slice.
He looks a lot like the Super Apes from that issue of Fantastic Four that we read last time.
He looks kinda like Ray Liotta with cauliflower ears. Cauliflower.
Cauliflower.
Yeah.
And is about as intelligent as Ray Liotta when Anthony Hopkins is eating his brain in Hannibal.
Yeah.
The art is inconsistent to me. I mean, Stark is still drawn well, but the mask is drawn differently almost every single time.
And that's a good reason. You know, you bring up the art, Todd, and that's one thing we probably should touch on here a little bit. Whereas the vast majority of our reading list at this point have been drawn by either Kirby or Ditko, here we're getting a little bit of an exposure to Don Heck as an artist. And so I found myself liking the art at times, but I think you're right. It is very inconsistent from page to page or even panel to panel.
Yeah, I think he draws the civilian stuff pretty well, fairly photorealistic. Like he'd be at home at a romance book or something like that. But to me, his action stuff and especially his Asian caricatures are subpar, to say the least.
Tim, you haven't really had a lot to say about these so far. I'm sure they were just as bad to you as they were to us.
They were. I mean, even if you are like a terrible person who can just look past the racism and the misogyny, you're still not going to find anything that's really worthwhile in this. There's maybe the germ of a good idea in exploring Tony Stark's personal life. You know, they're trying to do this whole love triangle thing, but you know, the power dynamics just make it all so gross, and the characterizations of these people are just awful. They are all written so horribly unlikably.
Pepper's only purpose in life is to pursue Tony. That's it. That's all she is as a character.
To admire Tony Stark and to I can't even. I mean, do not read these comics. This is like a hard avoid at all costs. These are really embarrassing.
Well, I'm curious as to if they corrected the skin tone. What was the skin tone drawn like or colored in the original newsprint editions of these? So let's hope they corrected it.
Yeah,
I'm speculating that it wasn't the same, just because the characterizations are certainly different. And why does the Mandarin have a giant M on his chest if he's in China?
Or how about, let's assume for a moment that the Mandarin were called something completely different and were just an average white character. You know, they tell us in the course of the book that he's a super genius, but Iron Man makes him look like a complete idiot at times when he's like, you know, you've captured Tony Stark and you better be worried about where he's at, because, you know, that same room that I busted out of, he was in there. So that means he's loose in the castle. And the Mandarin doesn't put two and two together. He's like, you know what? You're right. I'm just going to leave you here and assume everything's going to go to plan. What?
He is the Dr. Evil of the Marvel Universe to this point. Yeah. We assign him genius only because the writers tell us he is.
Yes.
But in all of his actions, he demonstrates that he is a complete dullard.
Yes.
An impossible to retcon. How would you do it?
Yep.
Right. In my headcanon, I'm going to say either like more than half of his rings don't work, or he hasn't actually figured out how they work, because he's so reliant on these stupid gimmicks that, I mean, you've got 10 power rings that he could basically do anything with, right? Mm-hmm. And he's using all these dumb, he's using karate, right, that we talked about, fluently or not. He's also got all these little death traps built into his castle. I mean, what are we doing? Just, who is this character? He's very ill-conceived, it feels like.
I agree 100%.
Let's talk about the pros on both the cover and the splash page. See the Mandarin. The awesome power he possesses matches the evil in his heart. On the splash page, we have a favor to ask of you. Do not start reading this tale if you are in a hurry. Oh, thanks. Thanks so much, Dan.
I wrote that down, too. Yeah, I looked upon that.
It wasn't so much a suggestion as it was a warning.
And yep.
It was awful. And Tales of Suspense 54 doesn't get any better.
No, we're just talking about, you know, all of this Mandarin stuff in general. I don't really feel the need to break down this stuff plot point by plot point, because there is no plot to speak of. There's the Mandarin being outwitted at every turn by Tony Stark. There's the god-awful love triangle stuff. And really, not until Tales of Suspense 57 do we see anything, you know, not directly involving the Mandarin. And while it's better because it's not being racist as all hell, it's not that much better, because this issue gives us the debut of Hawkeye as a villain, and also introduces us, you know, for our project anyway, to the Black Widow. We had not been exposed to her previously in the course of this project. So
yeah, I think she debuted in 53.
While this was a little better, I still just kind of shrugged my shoulders. I don't know about you guys. I didn't buy the Hawkeye villainous motivation at all, but maybe you guys had a different view on it.
I didn't buy him as a villain at all, and this issue is a complete bait and switch, because they advertise it to you as Hawkeye is this new villain. They even say it in the issue that he's going to be the new great villain introduced into the Marvel Universe, only for that to actually turn out to be Black Widow. And Hawkeye's whole origin really just makes him seem kind of like an unfortunate idiot who happens to be, you know, a marksman and has maybe the worst possible motivation for putting on a costume ever, and that's, people made fun of me. So now I'm going to go on being a costumed adventurer because people love Iron Man more than they love me. By the way, my job before this was circus performer.
Yes,
that was fucking tastic. It's dumb as hell, but not to keep Tony Stark himself from being thrown under the bus a little bit, because somebody needs to teach this guy proper flying form. Because every time he's drawn in flight, he is full spread eagle. I'm like, man, if it's that bad, build more room into the crotch of your suit so that you don't look like that whenever
maybe,
you fly.
Maybe that's how the transistors work, Russell. Maybe he has to have them all spread out for them to achieve maximum thrust or whatever.
Well, at least now I know where the greatest American hero learned his flying technique from.
Oh, man.
There's your deep cut.
Absolutely. Tim, was this any better to you?
Look at what's happening.
Actually, you know what? So at the end of Tales of Suspense 55, we get the caption, "Starting next-ish, every Iron Man story will be a full 18 pages long." And I just despaired once again.
Is that why does Stan Lee hate us?
Yeah, it's just we are not off to a rousing start here, but I will say that 57 was an improvement over the preceding three that we looked at by leaps and bounds. Not that it's any great shakes, but
I too agree with that.
Okay, so I too was a little bit confused by Hawkeye's motivations here, because it seems starting out he's not really fancying himself a villain. He actually is stopping this robbery in progress, I guess, and makes a point to do so rather humanely. Like, he doesn't maim this guy as he could have based on his weaponry of choice. So it's sort of like, all right, is he going to be just another like costume vigilante? But then it's a case of mistaken identity, big misunderstanding, as these things often are, and then he turns to villainy, hooks up with the Black Widow, who, by the way, her design has a long way to go, doesn't it?
It really does. And also, can we remark that Hawkeye is also the Ted Mosby of this story? Mm-hmm. He basically Mosby's Black Widow. I mean, telling
that
would
her rely upon me knowing more about how I'm. But
the I love you on a first date.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that happens. That actually happens here. Hawkeye doesn't even realize he has no idea he's being played by a Soviet spy. Right. And yet he's like completely and utterly in love with her. Basically, Hawkeye is a big fucking idiot throughout this issue. But that's kind of, as we've pointed out, par for the course. But still, my favorite line of the issue came from Iron Man, and it goes as such. "Strong nylon rope strands tangling me up. Can't repulse them in time." So if you're out there, supervillains, you're taking notes on how to beat Iron Man. Strong nylon ropes. That's all you got to have.
No, I am glad you pointed that out, because have you all noticed that this Iron Man, whose armor has changed, by the way, since our last episode, he's not in the big, clunky suit anymore. He now has sort of a more streamlined, what I consider the turtle shell armor.
Yep.
With the inconsistent helmet that we noted. So here, the helmet has been sort of shaved down. He doesn't have, like, the horns in either direction, but they still take a few passes at that before settling on something. Anyway, he is relying more on gadgetry than real weapons that are built into his suit, and I'm kind of interested in tracking when that turn is going to take place, you know, because he's sort of at one point he deploys roller skates from his boots.
Yes, right? 55.
I don't think it was
he does.
Yeah, in issue 55. So
yeah, because it takes less power from his transistors, apparently, to power the roller skates than it does to fly. So he's conserving his battery.
Yeah.
At no point anyway, have we heard the word repulsor uttered.
Nope.
So no repulsors. And Hawkeye has a lab.
That's right. He already does have a lab.
He has a lab. So, you know, Clint Barton, also a scientist. So we also see Hawkeye in his circus gimmick, and that is a throwback to The Last of the Mohicans. So Stan Lee has read some of the American classics.
Mm. Well, Stan Lee did want to become, the next great American novelist once he put his comics career behind him, so as legend goes. But that would never happen.
Do you guys notice that Tales of Suspense 57 also promises that the next issue we'd get the thrilling origin of Iron Man, and in the next issue, And I was left thinking, didn't we already get that last year?
Or wasn't it like, let's make it just a little less racist? Was that the idea?
I have perhaps. No idea. I thought about taking a look, but then I realized I want nothing less in this world than to revisit that issue.
Well, I figure they do a lot of these sort of retellings because they figure their audience today was not necessarily their audience then. I'm sure they've seen their servers grow exponentially, you know, month after month. So they're trying to, I guess, you know, sticking with that old adage, every issue is somebody's first. So you get that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely feels like a lot of things are refreshed or touched upon repeatedly for a lot of these books over these first few years. So who knows what that was. Wasn't on our reading list, so I did not take the time to read it. But one thing that was on our reading list and could arguably be the most historically notable issue of 1964 is Avengers number 4. And this, of course, is best known for the introduction of Captain America into the burgeoning Marvel Universe and into the Avengers specifically. So, guys, I know Tim, I know you and Todd both are massive Captain America fans, so I will let you guys take it away. Todd, I know you were really looking forward to revisiting this one. How did it hold up for you?
Well, that cover sure is nice.
No.
Story, there is not much there other than you get kind of a crisis of character once Captain America himself returns and goes through, oh, I'm in this modern world and I have nothing to live for. What? Why bother? Oh, wait, there's a teenage boy who reminds me of Bucky, so I will put my hands on his shoulders and now I will fight crime. Oh, also, there was an asparagus man, as we see in the planet the Dark Phoenix consumes, right? Is that right, Tim?
Yes. So this is... Yeah, this rando alien that shows up, who, by the way, was the inspiration behind Medusa in Greek mythology. So that's something kind of up there with the Thing being Blackbeard the pirate, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
This alien, he is a member of the Dabari. And, you know, you see a lot of these one-off alien races, right, in early Marvel comics that... for the most part, are never to be seen again. Well, the next time we see these fellas, it kind of propels, sets into motion one of the most landmark comic stories ever of all time. We'll get there.
We'll get there. Yeah, we're plugging our own show and we're burying the lead here. But
little bit, yeah.
Yeah, so Namor inadvertently causes the frozen, not corpse, but the frozen body of Captain America to be eventually found and returned to the Avengers, they bump
what
into
a coincidence.
Him. What an amazing coincidence.
And not without a little dose of racism to go with it.
People
in the Inuit, people are not dumb, asshole. That's how he writes them.
Yeah, that
well,
was...
it's hard to complain about that too much as someone who has read a lot of early Green Lantern, where let's just say Tom Kalamaku was not well
served. I'm craving some pie. How about you?
Yeah. And I do like, though, that this issue picks up on story threads from Fantastic Four Annual Number 1.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Though apparently there was a fight between Namor and the Avengers that we missed out on from our reading list. So
number three, and it caused the Hulk to leave, so... kind of the beginning of the supervillain team up, but between Hulk and Namor.
And I got
to and that's one thing we should mention about this issue. In addition to the introduction of Captain America to the team, it also marks, you know, like Todd said, Hulk leaves in issue 3, and we're going to get a little mini arc here that we're going to discuss of kind of Hulk versus the Marvel Universe as a whole. He kind of runs through a bunch of different titles, and before eventually settling in his own feature in an anthology book, I believe, in Tales to Astonish, or maybe I'm wrong on that.
Ben was talking about how, Hulk didn't work the first time around as this Mr. Hyde / Frankenstein / Aurora model kit character brought to life in comics. So let's give him a heel turn and hope he becomes the cool heel. And by gosh, it kind of worked eventually.
It does. Yeah, I would agree. Tim, what about you? What were you? What were your thoughts on this reread here?
So I've read this particular issue a bunch of times, not in many years, but it's one that was reprinted like in the back of some Avengers anniversary issue from the 90s, right? So that's probably the first time I encountered it, and just over and over growing up, I had reread this issue without necessarily loving it, but trying to understand its historical significance. And you know, in our last episode, I talked about how Stan Lee's concept for mutants, where he's just foregoing superhero origins for them, saying that they are born with their powers, was sort of a narrative cheat, right? But mm-hmm. worked really well because it's opening up a whole new world for him to explore. And I think reviving Captain America is a little bit similar to that. It's another kind of cheat that he's employing. It's a hack where, not hack work, but it's a writer's hack where he's just plucking him out of that wartime setting, dropping him into present day. So this flashback that we get with Cap and Bucky and how he was ultimately frozen in ice, Bucky dies. I mean, none of that happens.
Nope.
It's just a
total retcon.
Total retcon. And I mean, it will be subsequent writers who come into the picture and kind of fill in the gaps in terms of, well, how were there all these other post-war Captain America comics? Because that series went on for years and years after the war. And we get an answer for that.
Stan did try to bring back Cap before FF, too. You know, or try to keep Cap going all the way till, I think, 57, 58.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Lee himself was in the service for a while and wasn't the sole writer of those early Captain America comics. So there is an interest. Yep. Mm-hmm. There is an interesting history with that character and kind of Stan's relationship with him. I mean, he is the first superhero that Stan Lee contributed work for. He got his big break doing text pieces within the original Captain America comics. So you can see how he has a fondness for him.
And speaking of people who have a fondness for the character, can we remark on how good the Kirby art is on this issue?
Yeah, this is 100% Kirby. Like you see,
yeah,
this is the Kirbiest of Kirby issues to me.
Yeah,
he had, sure his passion for drawing Cap is really evident. Because even though he's drawing the other characters really well, but every time Cap is on panel, I was kind of taken aback by just how detailed and how much effort it seemed like Kirby was putting into making him look like the best character in the book. And to me, that says, you know, Kirby was, wasn't he the original artist on Captain America?
Yeah, Simon Kirby.
Way back when. So it seems like when that character went away for a while, maybe Kirby had lost a little bit of his passion, but now that he's back, it's like, this real fire has been lit under Kirby, and he's really firing on all cylinders here. So even though there's some super dumb, silly stuff that happens in this issue, it all looks very pretty in process. One of my biggest gripes that I was just kind of head-desking over was the way they prove that he's the real Captain America is they all want to have a fight. And I was like, so this is where Dragon Ball Z got it from.
Well, you know, Cap is awfully spry after all those years on ice, too.
God, they keep using spry.
Yeah, he's... and did you notice that Stan Lee inadvertently makes Wasp the smartest person in the room during that sequence? Because she steps in and kind of cools everybody off. And as soon as she does that, everybody's like, oh, yeah, he must really be the real Captain America, because now that we've taken a minute to actually calm down after this fight and how well he did, we totally believe him. And
right.
That's how that works.
Right. But your point is well taken there, that Kirby does a really nice job just making Cap stand apart from everything else around him. He seems to really be putting the effort in to do that. And granted, the man out of time thing is a retcon. That's, you know, the shortcut I was referring to. It works really well because now you can have this added dimension to his character. I mean, there's a sadness to this guy in some of the scenes that we follow him as he's kind of grappling with questions of has the world so moved
much,
on.
So much Bucky guilt, and I didn't recall that being as prominent in my memory of this issue, but it's really to the core of the character, so much that it informs both the Winter Soldier and the Civil War movies to me. Like, whoa, Cap really is hung up on Bucky dying, even the modern iterations of the character.
Also speaks about how he views Rick and this issue. But I do have a question, and you guys are probably a little bit more familiar with older Captain America than I am. Is this pre or post Super Soldier Serum retcon? Because it reads like it's pre. It reads like he's not a super soldier necessarily. Like he's just a well trained guy who just happened to be frozen in ice.
No, the Super Soldier Serum was always part of his origin.
I was under the impression that it wasn't.
No, I think there is some confusion stemming from, did it actually give him superpowers, which they've gone back and forth on that.
Is he like Deathstroke, where he's got the everything to the nth degree of normal humanity, or is he a meta? Mm-hmm. You know, and then that's I think where they go. But this issue's fun, and yet there's some dumb as shit stuff. But and Namor. I still appreciate it, and it's good to see Thor whip some ass. It's kind of the classic Avengers, and it's to me the high point of the Avengers until they totally blow it up for me, this issue. Mm-hmm. Even though it's not great, it's not the best issue we'll read in 1964, but probably the most important one, the most historic one. Rick Jones brings it down just a little bit, even though he had a function in kind of hitting the reset button on Cap. But Rick Jones ruins and his, everything.
The Teen Brigade comes in and they still suck.
They drop.
I am realizing how much I really hate Rick Jones. I didn't know this about myself or about that character before, because he's always been a long time, you know, mainstay sort of supporting character in the Marvel Universe. And I mean, I've had limited exposure to him, but my God, he really does ruin everything.
Yeah, he's awful. I mean, like I said last episode, so many areas where Stan learned from the competition, and this is one where he didn't. He is Snapper Carr level bad, and that is saying something if you've ever read any Snapper Carr. Although I will give him one shout out. You know, the inclusion of Rick Jones in this issue does at least give us my second favorite love triangle of 1964 Marvel, as we have Rick Jones, Bruce Banner, and Steve Rogers, who are all super, like, you know, there's a lot of angst right there.
Yeah, it's Namblo's favorite love triangle, too, I think.
Oh.
So,
man.
I think it's going to be good, but I had a good laugh about Rick calling Cap crazy at one point. I mean, I understand, you know, senility, it's a terrible thing, and even Cap isn't immune, but... I wanted to remind Rick that he is the one who drove his car out into a nuclear test site just before a new weapon was going to go off. So when we're talking about crazy, come on, Rick.
You know,
come on
I now. Think there is a Warren Ellis level idea where somebody can go back and retcon Rick Jones as being evil and this catalyst to make all these things happen, because he sucks as a character otherwise. So if you could do something cool with Rick Jones being malevolent and a dupe or something like that that caused all this shit to happen in the MU. Oh, man, I got to sell this idea.
I think I might love that.
Yep.
I would really like that. And one other thing I do want to say that I liked about this issue before we moved on is you guys mentioned that once Thor comes in, he gets the best lines. He's the best part of the issue. But I loved seeing him and Cap just come in and completely wreck shop whenever they get a chance to do
they
it.
They fight well together.
Yeah, they do. They were a killer team, and both of them feel like as close to fully formed, and they're like almost their modern incarnations of all of these characters. So I'm actually, even though this whole celery man bit didn't really work for me, I'm on board with Cap and Thor as they are. I think they're both great characters.
I have a couple things.
Yeah.
Before we move on and get it, we have a couple really bad lines. We have Tony Stark or Iron Man telling Captain America, "I noticed it took a threat to the boy to bring you into action, fella." So that, and then we have our moment of misogyny with where did the Wasp go? She was powdering her nose.
Powder her nose. One step forward, two step back, Stan.
Yeah, classic.
One step forward, just step back.
Yeah. Just Stan gonna stand in 1964.
And we'll get an equally bad, if not worse, Wasp line coming later.
Yes,
in another Avengers book we'll talk about in the second half of the show.
Yep. So this to me is kind of like the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. It's the country's in the doldrums, and you have Captain America coming back and leading the way with the Avengers. And again, this cover, the cover to me is more iconic than the issue itself. I mean, even though Cap defrosting is kind of like Submariner, who doesn't remember Captain America and suppose, you know, they fought together in the 40s. They were in the same Human Torch comics together in the 40s, but have no memory of one another.
You know what? I did no-prize that one, actually. Since when we were reintroduced to Namor, he is amnesiac, right? So maybe his memories have not fully returned just yet.
Fine. That's a good point. Great point, Todd. Or Tim, excuse me. I think that's a our first no prize of the episode going over to Tim, probably.
Okay.
Excellent. But from the fourth issue of Avengers, let's hop over to the fourth issue of another extremely notable team book, and that, of course, is the Uncanny X-Men, number four, featuring the debut of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants and the return of Magneto to the pages of the title. I got to say, just real quick, you know, we talked about X-Men number one, and we kind of had, you know, varying opinions on it. I think we all came down on the side of liking it ultimately, but feeling like there were better things ahead for the book. And this is where we start to see some of that. I really, really enjoyed this issue. Getting the mastermind Scarlet Witch dynamic was really cool. Getting to see from the very beginning the overprotective nature of Quicksilver as it relates to his sister. That dynamic of the Brotherhood just works all the way through. And it's cool to set up to begin to evolve that idea of Xavier and Magneto as really these two warring philosophies who are carrying out their mission in different ways, even though they have, you know, similar goals. You have both of them leading teams of young mutants, trying to instill their philosophies in them. So I dug everything about this issue in terms of expanding the X-Men mythos. And I'm pretty sure, Tim, you've probably got lots of thoughts on this one as
well. Go, Tim.
Yeah, this was pretty fun. It's the first time we've seen Magneto since that first issue, and with this being a bi-monthly series, that's quite some time, in fact. But it kind of cements him as their arch nemesis. He is going to be a recurring threat over and over. We get some notable introductions, first appearances for Quicksilver, Scarlet Witch, Toad, and Mastermind. Now they're referred to as the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. Obviously, that's very Silver Age-y, but maybe you can smooth it over by trying to say it's like a ironic political statement. I don't know. That one's a little bit harder to no prize away.
Yeah.
But it is what it is. You know, they are in the South African nation of, what's it called, Santa Marco, which I don't know if, did Kirby get the memo, because sure looks like one of those stereotypical Eastern European countries. So that's a little bit strange that this is supposed to take place in South America, but it is what it is. You know, we've got townspeople with torches and pitchforks, right? So,
yeah, I was a big fan of the art on this one as well. That Kirby art, man, he is on fire with these these number fours. That Danger Room bit was awesome, by the way. I really dug that a lot. And finally, Beast is being more and more like the Beast I know and love.
Yeah,
the Ben the Ben Grimm caricature he was, that's gone. He's doing complex formulas with his feet. I love it. I love it. It was so good. He was my favorite character in this issue.
Yeah, the characterizations have grown dramatically in three issues. Even issue three, which I went back and reread because I had it as a kid, so I went back and reread it on this just for some extra context. And even by three, Beast is using the big words and being very different than Ben Grimm. And
he's reading books.
Yes. He's developing that kind of Shakespearean accent a little bit too. At least multi-syllabic that's how I was reading words. Him.
But even all the characters, Warren is a little more vain. Scott's a little bit more of a leader, and he is Scott here.
Right.
You know, they have their individual personalities a lot more developed now. Even though it's bi-monthly, they're still getting a lot of development in. And it is fulfilling this little pattern of you have the Danger Room stuff, the first couple issues. Almost every X-Men issue we read has that happening no matter what. And then they stop and then the threat is introduced and Professor X gives them their instructions or senses something. Yeah. But definitely a formula.
And Nick, you touched on this, the debut of not so much a character, but a convention of X-Men comics, which is Professor Xavier and Magneto having one of their little telepathic conferences here on the astral plane, which is not called that, but we will know that that is what it is. And it's sort of, I don't know, I think this is where people, you know, really go to that idea of the parallels between these characters and real life counterparts as Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, right? Which I've never been totally cool with that comparison just because it seems a little bit reductive and not really fair to the real people. but setting that aside, we'll leave it alone. We obviously, Stan is getting at something here. He's really broadening that idea of, you know, it's not just good mutants, evil mutants. There's implications for the world here. And a warring of philosophies, really. And that's going to, I mean, really overtake the series as a theme in subsequent years.
Did you notice, too, that this has, speaking to your point there, Tim, kind of out of nowhere, this has a really well thought out and complex plot at its heart. That you've got Scarlet Witch, a character who is on the side of quote unquote evil here, but she's conflicted about everything that they're doing. She has a real internal conflict going on about the morality of what Magneto's mission actually is, even though she sees that maybe it is for the greater good, but at what cost, and maybe that matters.
It's almost like he had it planned out.
Yes, very much so. And you also get not just them, but ancillary characters bringing up some good points. Because Magneto wanted to have this whole like country to himself. I guess this is kind of the beginnings of how he wanted to have a mutant society like set aside all along.
Yeah.
But you have these, you know, he's using Mastermind's powers. He's created this illusion of an army, and everybody quickly surrenders as a result. But one of the actual soldiers who winds up serving Magneto but was a native to this country remarked that, isn't it interesting that their entire government fell without a single shot being fired? And that, to me, that just hit me like, wow, they're really being observant of the complexity of this whole situation. And man, when Stan wants to, he can really write a damn fine plot. And this one, I think he nailed it on in pretty much every facet. Knocked it out of the park, giving us all of these great characterizations, and even throwing in a little bit of humor in there to see Jean clowning on Cyclops early in the issue for that. that was my impression of issue four. Never would have thought from issue one that this is where we would have wound up. Issue four was absolutely great. One of my favorite issues we've read so far.
So yeah, issue 4 was definitely a lot of fun, a big step up, as you said, Russell. But for this project, we also read issue number 7, and this features the Brotherhood attempting to recruit the Blob, a character who apparently the X-Men had encountered earlier in some issues that weren't on the reading list, but this provides another opportunity for the two teams to interact. But notably, it also provides that opportunity for the first occurrence of something that has become kind of a trope in X-Men comics, and that's Xavier just saying, fuck this shit, I'm out of here, and just leaving for no adequately explained reason. Because early in the book, he gives the X-Men their diplomas, declares that they have graduated from his school, and thus is leaving them with Scott Summers as the new headmaster slash leader of the team. Tim, I know this probably spoke to you, because this puts Cyclops officially in that leadership role fairly early on in the X-Men's existence. And like you were saying last time, whereas a lot of this stuff that we think of as Cyclops being the classic, you know, leader of the team, it really feels like in these early pages that's a role that was probably more suited for Angel, and yet it winds up going to Cyclops here, which I thought was really interesting. So while I didn't enjoy this issue as much as I did 4, I did find a lot of the early stuff with Xavier leaving and the setup of Cyclops as leader and just kind of how they're exploring that dynamic and how that character is evolving here, I found that really, really interesting.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff they do with especially Cyclops and Angel, it's sort of swervy role reversal to kind of toy with your expectations in these early outings for X-Men. This is just the 7th issue, and you know, we get a graduation ceremony. I mean, they are effectively, I guess, done being gifted youngsters or attending the school for gifted youngsters here. I find it a little bit odd that they have all graduated at the same time, supposedly, given their different ages. But because it's stated right in that first issue that Beast is a little bit older, Bobby a little bit younger.
And they've all been at school for years, and Jean just gets there.
Jean just gets there, yeah.
What kind of accelerated program is she on?
I guess so. Well, I guess...
He had his favorites, right?
Right. I'm going to just leave that alone. I was going down a dark road with that, but I'm leaving my dark passenger in the other room. So, in any case, yes, we get a promotion for Cyclops, the first of many. I don't know if it's even the first, really, but a very high profile dick move by Professor X that he's going to go to that well a lot. In this series, just the way that he kind of fucks with them to, I guess, teach them a lesson in discipline. You need to learn discipline. He's kind of laying that on. Oh God, that's messing me up now. Yes, we have the Blob returning after his first appearance in issue 3. Todd mentions reading that. And at the end of that issue, his memories were wiped by Professor X. And so, after a knock to the head, his memories are restored in this issue, right? So, that old trope. And is joining the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, allegedly. What else do we have here? We had... have we seen the Coffee a Go-Go yet? The little coffee shop they hang out in?
I don't
know. Isn't that in this issue?
In this issue. I didn't know if we'd seen it.
I believe so.
Yep. Prior. We have the village.
Yep. The Grinch Village Harriet, coffee shop.
This was not the greatest Jack Kirby issue, although Beast getting his foot drawn, a face drawn on his foot by a hippie is pretty great.
The 60s were a weird time, man. They were worshiping his feet.
Well, Bernard the Poet. You know, we've got some Zen poetry in this issue. I mean, I guess I like these little elements of world building. I mean, they are called the strangest teenagers of all, right? So I guess they ought to
let's let them act like teenagers. Yeah, but like I said, there's a dramatic difference in the art between this and 4, and I don't know if it's inks or just Kirby doing a rush job because he's got 15 million books coming out every month, but. There's a very distinct difference, although we do have some great Kirby machinery in the Danger Room area, or Cerebro. His version of Cerebro is pretty Kirby.
Wasn't, this was our introduction to Cerebro, wasn't it? This is the first time that it's ever seen, if I'm remembering right.
Yeah, I think
but there is one bit. There is one bit that I think Tim would really appreciate in this issue. Not just that this is maybe the most humanizing Blob story that I've ever seen. It actually made me really care for the character. But there's a moment whenever he's trapped, like he's been tied down, and you're wondering how he's going to get out of it. And the only way I can describe his escape plan is Fathead.
Yeah.
You're welcome, Tim. I've been waiting to work that in.
Oh, well done.
Blob was smoking a cigar almost all of issue 3, and he doesn't have the cigar here. He's drawn a little thinner here relative to issue 3.
Thinner.
But Magneto's a gypsy, so we do have that connection. I guess, what do you guys think the historical significance is of this? Just the another good example of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants versus the X-Men and Xavier leaving? Or
I guess the graduation aspect, and I would also assume the Blob kind of beginning his affiliation with the Brotherhood. Because granted, I'm not the X-Men expert that you guys are, but when I think of the Brotherhood, I typically imagine the Blob as being part of the, you know, more iconic lineup or whatever. So
yeah,
I would assume for the graduation and for the Blob Brotherhood stuff.
And Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch are not long for the team. Spoiler alert.
Right. Right.
Well, they're being presented as very reluctant members in the first place, which is some nice characterization for these. You know, they could just be kind of lackeys, right? Mm-hmm. They don't have to necessarily be characters in their own right when you have this team, and you know they're just kind of flunkies to throw at the X-Men. It's not what Stan and Jack were going for with those characters and with that team. So that's pretty impressive. You know, we talked about this is maybe the meatiest Cyclops gets in terms of character. So just giving some sense of, you know, the person he will grow and develop into over the years, maybe that's part of why it's on the list. Because we haven't seen a ton from him in terms of just his leadership abilities. I mean, we had kind of the brooding loner weirdo part from first few issues, but Slim. Here is where it's, Slim coming into his own more and developing beyond that. So that is notable. Hey, and the Coffee a Go-Go that I mentioned, maybe that's why it's so very important to 1964 Marvel.
And there are
no
hints that Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver are Magneto's kids at this point, right?
No,
not at all. And I'm kind of with Tim there. I think the only reason that this issue is notable is because of the promotion of Scott Summers. Getting to see him be a bit, you know, more of a strong leader. I actually gained a new level of respect for Cyclops in this issue, just because he's sacrificing being, you know, a normal regular person. Like he's had this burden laid on him. Also, after he confides in, I forget, it was either Beast or Iceman, that he tells that he was thinking of leaving the team altogether. And when the professor lays this on him, he decides to stick around and accept the responsibility of it, because it made him feel like he had more of a purpose. But one interesting thing that I think we should note about that is this is the beginning of the conflict between Cyclops and Professor X that's going to come up later. This is where that resentment is going to start to build, because this is going to become a recurring act for Professor Xavier, and there are going to be more times than not where he leaves Cyclops kind of holding the proverbial ball. And it actually turns out that, you know, Cyclops is doing the best he can with what he has, and Professor X, if he really wanted things to not go in the shitter, maybe he should stick around and take a little more responsibility for the thing that he has built. And Cyclops is, you know, put in this unfortunate position, but he's trying his damnedest to hold it all together. And in this particular case, he does it without Professor Xavier being there, because once Xavier is gone from those first few pages, we don't see him anymore. Mm-hmm. Not even the end. Nope. He doesn't swoop in to save the day. It's all on Cyclops' shoulders to lead this team to any kind of victory. And I guess the end of the issue with Blob making the decision that he's not going to join the Brotherhood or the X-Men is probably about as good an outcome as they could hope for.
Yeah.
You also get Cyclops recognizing that Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch aren't as into this as the rest of the Brotherhood. You do see a lot of growth from Cyclops, and you see Professor X conveniently get out of the way, and there's some sledgehammer of plot about to happen with Professor X here in a couple issues. You're gonna, as Tim knows, as we'll probably find out next month.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Well, you know, one thing we talked about near the beginning of this episode is that, you know, in 1964 Marvel, most of the pieces are on the board. There aren't really a lot of new character debuts, save for one notable exception to that statement. And that, of course, is the 1964 debut of Matt Murdock, a.k.a. Daredevil. And so here on this reading list, we read both the first and fourth issues of Daredevil, created by Stan Lee, with art this time from a veteran comics artist, Bill Everett. Not Ditko or Kirby. So another example of Stan kind of going outside his usual, you know, go-to two guys in Ditko and Kirby. So, you know, these were issues, guys, that I had read a little while back, actually, after the first season of the Daredevil television show. I kind of got on a kick of Daredevil binge reading, and I went back and read this. And I think, for me, what stands out about these issues is I'm not saying that they're overly dark and grim by modern from a modern standpoint, but by the standards of the Silver Age, these are pretty dark. That Daredevil origin in issue one, where we see his father like murdered on panel, it does not get much more intense than that in 1964 Marvel. And I think bringing back a veteran artist like Bill Everett, who had been around for so long, who had probably done some of those anthology books with the, you know, the crime stories and the horror stories and stuff like that, probably served the book more than it would have to have, you know, Kirby do another book a month that he may not have been able to devote his full attention to, or have Ditko do something that he wasn't super into the way he was into Spider-Man or Doctor Strange. So these were two that I wound up liking a lot more than I feel like I probably should have. So I was big fans of both 1 and 4. You know, not as big a fan of 4, but 1 was really, really remarkable, I thought. Russell, what about you?
I was a pretty big fan of all of this. Daredevil is one of those that I think you and I have had several conversations about in the past, that he's very rare to have a bad run. There's mm-hmm. very rarely mm-hmm. a bad run of Daredevil ever. And I dug the hell out of this Bill Everett art. He gives things that, as you mentioned, a grittier look than most of the books we've seen up to now. But, I mean, still by... Folks, if you're going to judge it by modern standards, don't expect it to be like super grim and gritty. You got to put yourself in the mindset of the 1960s and mm-hmm. what you were typically getting. Pretty good opening here. It gets a little drawn out at times, I thought, but and this all despite the fact that I have never liked the yellow costume. The original Daredevil costume does nothing for me. I don't care for that look, but it's not long for this world. I know that it only takes a few issues before he goes full red. Also, not super high on quippy Daredevil. So that's something that I didn't necessarily dig in this issue. I prefer him being a little bit more, I guess, straightforward or not talking much whenever he's kicking ass. But luckily, this issue does move at a pretty brisk pace, despite a couple of slowdown moments, including one little teensy bits of racism that that Stan had to throw in there, I guess, because Stan gonna Stan. Indian wrestling, spelled wrestling. In case you thought we'd get through without any more racism, sorry. Nope, there's a little bit here. But gotta say, also a heavy Batman influence on this. As you get through this, if you don't pick up on the Batman parallels, you probably have never read Batman in your life. But, yeah, there's some of that. And overall, it has me intrigued. It made me really excited to read the next issue on our list, number four, which as I finished issue one, I went straight to number four without taking any kind of break because I was kind of immersed in the world at that point and couldn't wait to get to what we were going to do next.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you that, you know, quippy, jokey Daredevil is certainly something that I was not expecting, given that all the modern Daredevil you read, with the exception of perhaps the Mark Waid stuff, which, I mean, that's not really quippy, but it's definitely got a lighter and brighter tone than pretty much every Daredevil creator from, like, 1985 forward has had. So that was a little bit jarring to me, but ultimately, the overall tone of the story itself, I wound up thinking was pretty damn solid. And like you said, Bill Everett just really brings this gritty feel to the art that that Kirby and Ditko would not have been able to bring. And you also get, you know, from the jump, some of his supporting cast. Foggy Nelson is there from the get-go. Karen Page is there from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And Karen Page, unfortunately, is very much in the Pepper Potts vein, very much in the vein of, you know, Hope Van Dyne, or excuse me, Janet Van Dyne. You've got these female characters who... Stan must have had a crush on somebody in the office because all the love interests are like, you know, employees who are trying to sleep with their bosses. Like,
with Buffon.
It's the weirdest thing.
Mm-hmm.
And also Buffon. In this one, you also get this parallel to the Jane Foster character over in Thor because the primary reason why she can't see herself being with him seems to be the fact that he's blind and she feels sorry for him and takes pity on him for having a handicap. And it's just like,
also, only that ugly stuff just people does are not blind, play apparently, in Karen Page's mind.
You want to know?
Karen Page remarks at one point in issue four that you know, she can't believe that such a handsome fellow as Matt Murdock is also blind, because I guess in Karen Page's world, only ugly people are ever blind.
Only fascinatingly ugly
that aged
people
well.
Are ever blind. Yeah, none of this Don Blake or Matt Murdock stuff ages well, as it relates to the love interest, but very few love interests from 1960s Marvel in general. Very few romance subplots age well. So, I don't know, Todd. Were you as into this as Russell and I were?
You know, I was expecting it just because I remember the inner office kind of shenanigans of Murdoch, Page, and Nelson to be really obnoxious back in the day. But I got to tell you, the origin issue was pretty good and the art was kind of revelatory. This is Golden Age, but Golden Age artist Bill Everett, who drew Submariner way back in World War II era. And so he did all this great character work. Unfortunately, he's only here for, I think, the debut issue, if you look at the credits on Marvel Unlimited. But it gave it definitely a unique feel. Again, not a fan of the costume or a lighthearted Matt, especially, well, my dad died, but I'm still smiling. You know, he kind of got over it pretty fast, even though he had this vengeance of, you know, wanting to punish the killer of his parents, his father. He's always smiling, even with his glasses on. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's such a unique issue. Definitely different. We have a guy who is not a scientist becoming a Marvel hero. So that's
pretty
cool.
Notable. Yeah.
And I'd say I don't love the costume either, but like you, Todd, I really dug this Bill Everett art.
Yeah.
And I wondered if I was going to be alone in that, because I would say of the non-Kirby, non-Ditko artists that we've seen, I think I kind of like Bill Everett the best.
Yeah. I mean,
so far
that Tony Iron Man debut had some strong stuff, but this is very singular, very different from the rest. And again, I guess I can't hold Matt Murdock accountable for being blind and designing an ugly costume.
Well, true. Well, hey, he said that different colors have a different feel to his heightened senses, so. I don't know. I don't know what yellow feels like, man, but apparently he can pick it out.
That's a good point.
There were some behind-the-scenes production problems with this issue, which Ben Morris alluded to on the last Marvel Age Masterclass. Did a little independent study, research here, and apparently Bill Everett was living out in Massachusetts at the time. He was an art director somewhere and was just kind of working on this issue when he could, and what he submitted was something that was about two-thirds of the way complete, but not really all the way there. So Steve Ditko had to come in behind him and sort of finish up this issue. So I don't know how much of this is necessarily purely Bill Everett or a mix of the two of them. And, you know, as Todd mentioned, Bill Everett is gone. After this, we get we then get Joe Orlando, who I might like even better, actually.
Yeah, I was about to say that's a great way to transition into the discussion on issue four. You know, while Bill Everett is gone, I'm looking at some of these pages now, and Joe Orlando's faces, you know, facial expressions in issue four might be some of the most detailed faces we've seen in the Marvel Universe to this point, and it's really outstandingly detailed work for the time. I am just kind of blown away, especially by his depiction of Kilgrave, the Purple Man, who is a character that it's kind of cool to go back and see the earlier incarnations of, just because, you know, he's been so almost singularly defined by what Brian Michael Bendis did with him in the last 20 years or so. So, yeah, I wound up really enjoying issue four as well. Not to the level of issue one, but still pretty damn compelling stuff as far as I'm concerned.
No one can resist his purple power.
Mm.
Yes. Yeah. He's got great powers, but he's dumb as a box of rocks here. I mean, he fell for the monitoring shtick. I mean, for God's sake.
Right. A lot of what he does sort of seems like he's just kind of entertaining himself, because he can so easily get out of whatever situation he finds himself in. So,
except for a plastic sheet. Can't get out of a plastic sheet to save his life.
Nope, that's his undoing. Plastic sheeting, and he's done. Also, this one got a little bit heavy on the melodrama towards the end, but it was a solid issue overall. I mean, it's just slight step down from issue one, but overall, I thought this was still good.
Yeah, and I don't really actually mind quippy Daredevil that much, always smiling, as we mentioned. He has sort of that swashbuckling, roguish charm to him, and the nonstop, you know, talking during the fight scenes, it could be too reminiscent of Spider-Man, but it's not really to me. I didn't feel like it was, I could be reading a Spider-Man comic. You know, they do have different voices, which I think is pretty important and cool to see. So while it's not necessarily the Daredevil you're going to be used to, and you know, some of this I think reads more favorably in the light of something like that more recent Mark Waid run, where you did see a little bit more of that kind of lighthearted, at least on the surface, characterization.
Devil May Care.
Matt Murdock. Yeah.
Well, I will talk about Orlando's art specifically, because you see more of the same with the characterization, and Purple Man gets fooled, unfortunately, too easily here, but this art is almost timeless. This art could pass as 70s or, say, early 80s art. And Joe Orlando ended up working for DC and working on books like House of Secrets and House of Mystery, where he was an editor, I believe, or he was in production. So he was you don't see a whole lot of his work for Marvel. You just see Vinnie Coletta as an inker all over the place, and he is kind of a polarizing guy. But I liked it fine here. I mean, look at all the cross-hatching he does on everything here.
And he came from EC Comics.
EC Comics, the old horror line of the 50s, The Seduction of the Innocent. The art, to me, I love the cityscapes. I love the dialogue, the interpersonal stuff. The action stuff seems a little off to me at times, but foreshortening and things like that. But I really like the way Orlando does faces and some he creates some drama in the talking panels and not just the action. The action is a little awkward to me, but very, again, different. So far in Daredevil, we have two different unique artistic looks that have been different from Kirby, different from Ditko, different from Don Heck. You're seeing the universe develop a little bit. You're seeing a very different hero being introduced by Lee, and he's not necessarily a team player. You don't see him fitting on the Avengers, for instance. So, yeah,
and he definitely feels the most street level of the characters at this point. Yes, Spider-Man is street level, but he has, you know, the super strength and these fantastical powers. Whereas Daredevil, you know, while he has, you know, the enhanced senses or whatever, it's not like he's got super strength or whatever. It's not like he can go out and get himself out of these situations. You know, it just feels a little bit more grounded than a lot of the stuff to this point, while, you know, or as grounded as anything by 1964 standards could feel. So with all that being said, let's move along to the first family of the Marvel Universe and talk a little Fantastic Four in 1964. And I mentioned earlier that the Hulk leaving the Avengers in issue 3 of that title would bleed over into several other titles. And pretty much right here, this almost, guys, feels like a direct continuation of Avengers number 4 with Fantastic Four 25. And this one we see, you know, a promised Hulk versus Thing battle. And while we read an issue last year, or last episode, that promised a Hulk versus Thing battle and didn't really deliver upon that promise, this one absolutely does. This is almost just one extended long fight scene that takes up the vast majority of the issue. I thought it was hands down the best action of any book we've read for this project thus far, and arguably, it might be Kirby's best artistic work outside of, you know, some of that Journey into Mystery stuff that we've seen so far. I loved Fantastic Four 25. I was blown away by how much I liked it. Was not expecting that at all after seeing that Hulk versus Thing tease, because I figured it would be, you know, another false promise on Stan and Jack's part, but it absolutely was not. Todd, I know we talked a little bit off air beforehand. You were equally a big fan of this art and this issue. So kind of tell us your thoughts on it and what you saw specifically from Kirby here.
Well, dynamic fighting between not just Hulk and Thing, but Hulk and the entire FF have kind of the story contrivances of the Thing and Johnny rumbling a little bit, or Reed's testing out a gadget, and you just see this stuff happen every single issue. But this one's a little different because, well, yeah, they're, Alicia wanders into the where they are too, but they're investigating the Hulk, and the Hulk is changing a little bit, even though they call him again Bob Banner in this issue. Yet again.
Bob Banner. He's
Bob Banner. So I don't know if that's a letterer thing at this point, or they've done the retcon of Robert Bruce Banner. But yeah, this is a fantastic issue, so to speak. You do have just a big build up to the fight. And does this one have a cliffhanger or no?
Yes.
Going into 26.
It ends with the Thing kind of being beaten, essentially. Like, the Hulk wins the fight, and then the Thing is kind of motivated by that loss, essentially. And he promises to fight back in a big way, and he kind of picks himself off the ground, dusts himself off, and promises to continue the battle in issue 26. So it's one of those direct two-parters that, again, kind of fits in. You know, you could kind of read this and go all the way back to Avengers 3, I would assume, and kind of read it as one long story. Because then right there into issue 26, that's when, you know, the Hulk actually catches up with the Avengers and has that, you know, confronts Rick Jones and Captain America for jilting him, essentially. For, you know, it's really compelling stuff all around. And we get that. You know, into 26, we also get the first meeting of the Avengers and the Fantastic Four, and they do the classic superhero trope of they have to fight before they can align themselves. But I don't know, just you really have to look at them as one big story because they are so interconnected. Just blown away by this, honestly. It was simplistic storytelling, but simplistic storytelling that was served by the artist, who was Jack Kirby at the peak of his power.
I will say the art was very dynamic, but it wasn't very detailed, if that can be, both things can be true. You know, kind of rough on the finishes and backgrounds, but still you had these big, powerful pages and the kinetic energy of the fight between the two behemoths. So, you know, it's historic, and they definitely figured, oh, this is what the people really want. We want the big throwdown. We don't want this little cock tease that we got last year. We want the Hulk being Hulk smashing, so to speak.
And speaking of catchphrases, we almost got our first clobber in time out of the Thing during that fight. I was really taken aback. I'm like you guys. I was really taken aback by how much fun this fight is, and how, Todd, I think you said it right, dynamic. the artwork is. And if this whole issue could have just been the Hulk and Thing fight from page one all the way to the end, my God, I wouldn't have complained a bit. It is just something to behold. But there is one other thing about this issue, and I think that most people already know this, but it bears repeating. Reed Richards is an asshole. He is a right prick at the beginning of this issue when he just won't take no for an answer from Ben Grimm, who finally came to terms with being the Thing. He's like, you know, my girlfriend likes me like this. Maybe I'm getting used to being like this. Maybe I don't want to be changed back. And Reed keeps trying to force this formula down his throat. Mm-hmm. And then whenever he won't do it, Reed accosts him like he's the worst person who's ever lived. And I'm like, Reed, shut the fuck up, you asshole. Whenever he gets sick later in the issue because he was screwing around with viruses that he apparently wasn't taking any form of care to protect himself from, my thought was, good, let him die.
See, I think Reed is on the spectrum. I mean, he doesn't listen to anybody. He tries to force his own things, his own expectations, and he can't empathize with anyone here. Although he does sacrifice himself a little bit when he gets taken out, so yeah, I think there's something really wrong with the way they write Reed Richards.
He's just a right prick, and I can do without him, and I can also do without Sue's pining over him as well. Those two bits of the issue really just grated on me, because at this point I had no sympathy for Reed Richards. So when something bad is happening to him, I'm just like, I don't give a shit. Look, what's happening with Thing? He's the one who's actually putting himself in harm's way right now. I want to read more of that.
Russell, if you knew somebody who could expand, you know, could alter their body at will, you would probably pine over them as well. So let's cut a little slack. Russell, we almost got a clobber in time. Last panel of this of issue 25, we did get a dear old Aunt Petunia name drop. So, you know, we talked about how early Fantastic Four, the Thing feels almost unrecognizable. But here, you know, 2 years later, that's not the case anymore.
No.
They have started to really get closer to that incarnation of the character that we all know and love.
He's the ever loving blue eyed Thing here. He is.
Yep.
Yeah, he is finally, if he's not calling himself that yet, I'm still like kind of on the edge of my seat waiting for him to say that for the first time. But he's totally become that character. They have found, I think, the perfect version of Thing now. Like, if they keep him like this, you're golden. You've really nailed it with a Thing, and with Human Torch. I feel like Johnny Storm is right on where he should be too.
Yeah, you definitely have the family feel between them now. You absolutely buy into that at this point.
Yeah, it's easy to.
Well, they figured out and tapped into that the Thing is at his best when he's fighting from behind, and the Hulk is a really good nemesis to throw at him and capitalize on that aspect of the character. Yeah, I love this story. These two issues taken as a whole, 25 and 26. I first read them in a trade paperback called Marvel's Greatest Superhero Battles. It's from 1978. I don't know why I owned it, because it would have been many, many years out of print by the time I was born. And so this trade paperback was beaten to shit. I mean, the spine was cracked, and when I pulled it out the other day, the middle had actually separated from the rest of the book. So while it was still readable, it was falling apart, and this was just one of those things that I went back to over and over and over, because even from the time that, you know, I first started reading comics as a little kid, and not having a lot of materials at hand, that was the one thing that I, you know, always went back to. And without knowing much about these characters, the Fantastic Four, the Hulk, the Avengers, just to see them all thrown together like that in one story was really cool, among other gems in that collection. But I don't have a lot to add to this other than to heap more praise on it. I wish, and I think that these two issues should have been the Fantastic Four annual for this year.
Mm-hmm. I think I mean, that, that, was, And that's a great segue, because also included on our reading list was the second annual for this year. And this is really remarkable if you think about it, because every book that we've read to this point has been so entirely focused on the hero, protagonists, on, you know, the big names that we know from the Marvel Universe. And here in Annual 2, you get something like 50 pages of story devoted in, you know, largely to Doctor Doom. You get an extended full-length version of his origin that reveals so much about that character that we didn't really know. And then you also get a brand new Fantastic Four tale with him as the lead villain that plays directly off that full-length version of the origin you get earlier. And so the whole annual kind of reads like this big, dramatic presentation for Doctor Doom. And, you know, one of the things throughout the first 2 years of Marvel that I was a little disappointed in was it did not feel like Doom, as I know him, was one of those characters that was fully formed. But I think this annual number two kind of marks the true emergence of the classic version of Doctor Doom onto the landscape. I really wound up enjoying this annual as well. While I agree with Tim, I don't know that I enjoyed it as much as 25 and 26. Todd, I know you're a massive Doctor Doom fan. You had to have loved this revisiting here for this reading list.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a classic and, again, iconic cover. You do have the short-term Marvel treatment of the logos for these annuals for both Amazing Spider-Man Annual number one and the first two Fantastic Four annuals are four color. Three color anyway, where each letter is a different color. But this story feels bigger, and it's as though they were throwing Villain of the Month for a while, and then, oh, Doctor Doom was a little bit more popular, let's flesh out his story. And they left it, this story introduces a lot of elements, the connection to Reed, the gypsy upbringing, the nation of Latveria. So, and this goes in more of the connection to sorcery and his mother issues. So, yeah, this is a classic. It is Doom's kind of the main protagonist of this story. And then you get all these callbacks where he scars his face forever, and then he checks and sees if it's any better later in the issue. And, of course not, it's not. But, this is, while not necessarily as detailed and epic, and you look at the panels are kind of big on this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's four or five panels, they're not as detailed. I wouldn't say it's necessarily Kirby's best work, but you get Doom with the time traveling. He encounters this random, almost time traveling Pharaoh villain, which kind of seems like an afterthought when he is introduced, and they follow up, which is a great touch, because he's not in it very much. But looking through it now, you know, it's a little different as far as it's almost got an animation style to it, to the artwork. It is a little bit more simplistic, drawn big with these less detailed panels. But you also get this classic gambit of Doom and Reed Richards, you know, like Ben was talking with Tim, how he's the anti-Reed, and Reed makes Doom more interesting, and vice versa. You have Reed kind of challenging him to this almost Princess Bride-like duel where we have to drink these things, and no, I have developed an immunity to Iocane powder. And, you know, he outsmarts him with this illusion, because he was smarter. Technically, of course, Reed is going to be smarter. He's not clouded by witchcraft and mother issues at this point. so he outwits Doom by letting him think he's won. He projects that into Doom's head, and the four get away. And it's kind of a, like all these issues, they wrap up. It wraps up very quickly. The last two issues, boom, 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 end of story. We'll see you later, true believer. But, you know, it's memorable. And like I said, it doesn't live up to issue one or annual one, but you do have some of the same tropes. You just still have the extra pinups and the rogues gallery, and you have this one book length story. No reprints here. You know, still a tremendous value for your money. How much was this? Was this 25 cents?
A quarter, yeah.
One quarter in $1964. So, yeah, good Lord. Such a value. And again, that iconic cover. I love it.
Mm-hmm. And the Doom origin had to have been groundbreaking for the time. Just mm-hmm. reading it was some of my favorite reading we did this time, because it finally made Dr. Doom seem like the legit, deep villain that I've known him to be from the modern era. Getting this backstory on him and his backstory connection with Reed, which I felt was vital.
Huge.
To finally giving him that depth, because we had not gotten it up to this point. We had seen his origin, but that key part of it was left out.
That connection alone, Russell, takes him from being a recurring annoyance to the true, defining villain for the Fantastic Four.
He is absolutely the villain for them after that. Silliness, some of the silliness aside from the second story, but that first story is right on up there. And to allude back to something that the illustrious Ben Moore said on the most recent episode of Marvel Masterclass, where he proceeded to get ahead of us a little bit.
He's the fifth.
Yeah, he got a little bit ahead of us talking about some stuff from this issue about how when it comes to Reed Richards, Dr. Doom gets a big old case of the dumb. And he certainly does here by basically being fooled by his own plan. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be really hilarious. And it also takes this a bit off the rails towards the end. But still, really fun issue. This is one that I enjoyed quite a bit. I also appreciated that Dr. Doom was doing a John Lovitz from The Wedding Singer impression on page 15. Yep. You guys flip to that, you'll see it. And that was my first thought when I saw that panel with the red curtain being pulled in. I was like, yep, there he is. That's John Lovitz. And this, my God, my hatred of Reed Richards grows. Because he's not just an asshole. He's a sexist asshole in this one, because there's a moment when Sue Storm is fooled by the potion or whatever, the concoction that she has been served that made her hallucinate and made her think that she was seeing Reed Richards two-timing her, though I wasn't sure it was fully understood that they were indeed a couple. But of course, it's an illusion. She flips out, later comes to realize it, and says, tells Reed that she's sorry, she was being a fool. And Reed's response, no, Sue, you weren't being a fool, just a female.
There are lines like that in these issues.
I was like,
stay visible when you're talking to me.
And I was like, so, Stan, it's 1964 in your mind. Same diff?
Well,
yeah. That's where we are.
I'm conflicted about this just because you know that Sue Storm stirs the soup to Namor every gosh darn night.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
What a thing to say. Into picture. Yeah, I dug this issue not as much as their first annual or issues 25 and 26. I like the all Doom all the time aspect of it. Get that origin, which the Gypsy Village is a little bit
racist. Borat.
Yeah. It's a little, you know.
Common theme.
Yeah. But I did think that origin was the standout from this annual. Like the subsequent story in the present day, Doom's plot against the Fantastic Four, that felt a little thin, to be honest. Even though, yes, we do get the kind of the fun little mental showdown between he and Reed Richards, first of many to come, of course. But otherwise, that didn't totally knock my socks off. The Ramatut bit was truly bizarre.
Super random.
I'm so glad you brought that up.
25th century, right? 25th. Remember that.
Well, so, here's the thing.
Wait. You might be Dr. Doom. We could be the same person. And oh no, I've gone cross-eyed.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing.
How can we coexist?
How do you exist in the same space if you're me, and how can I go to the future if you're already there? And oh no, I've gone cross-eyed again. Dear God. This gets redeemed a little bit in my eyes later, but at this point, I was ready to like throw in the towel and be like, Stan, you're not smart enough to do time travel plot devices.
The time travel chicanery alone was too much. But the thing is, they had introduced this character earlier in the series, not an issue we read, but he just seemed like a character in his own right, you know, this kind of time traveler guy. And now they're playing with the idea that he's an alternate timeline future version of Doctor Doom, maybe, and then they even walk that back. So it was like clearly Stan and Jack were like, what do we do with this guy? And we're sort of throwing stuff at the wall and didn't even have their own minds made up. And I am glad that we get some resolution to that very quickly in another issue we're going
to
look at.
It's impossible for me to read this character and not think of Steve Martin, though, as King Tut.
This is just another example of maybe finish cooking your plot before you serve it.
Yeah, this was... that whole Kang, excuse me, not Kang, spoiler alert, that whole Rama Tut deal, I don't know, man, it just
Kang
didn't anything for me. Was exceedingly bizarre, and like you guys said, gets walked back to an extent later on, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But with all that being said, that brings a close to the first half of our episode. Stick around through the break. When we come back, we're going to have a lot of Amazing Spider-Man, a little bit more Avengers, some Journey into Mystery, and also some Doctor Strange to talk about. So stick with us. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place for Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceForNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place for Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaceForNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceForNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceForNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. We'll be right back.
Welcome back, dear Place to Be Nation listeners, to the second half of Marvel Age, Episode 3, covering 1964. And here for the second half, as I promised before the break, we're going to kick it right off and talk a little Amazing Spider-Man in 1964. You know, the year of 1963, we all had very high praise for what was going on in the pages of Amazing Spider-Man. Steve Ditko, you know, we kind of went with as our artist of the year. Most of us did anyway. We all kind of agreed that Spider-Man was the character of the year. And, you know, guys, in my opinion, that momentum just carries over into 1964. And so for our reading list, we picked up with Amazing Spider-Man number 11. And this book features the return of Dr. Octopus. He has been released from jail somehow, which is nonsensical, but that's just a trope of the superhero genre, quite frankly.
Hey, look, he fulfilled the entirety of his jail sentence already, okay? Yeah. So
his six-month jail sentence, yes.
Yes.
So he's back out. And it's here that we've, you know, this is one of those things where I have to criticize the reading list just a little bit and not to, you know, be too picky with a guy who provided us with a free resource. And again, that's Dave Busing over at comicbookherald.com. Reading list galore if you're looking to get into pretty much anything related to comics and want to know a good starting place. He's got tons of detailed reading lists out there. If you like what you see, go to his Patreon account and throw him a few bucks a month. He'll even build you and curate your own personal reading list for each month. But that plug aside for him, we kind of missed things here because the last thing we read, guys, was Amazing Spider-Man number 3. And in that book, we see a Peter Parker who is having no success with women whatsoever. It's kind of very much playing up that loner, you know, awkward kid aspect of everything. But by issue 11, he's in a love triangle. He's got the older Betty Brant, who is obviously super into him, and then he's also got Liz Allen, who is wanting to reject the jock, Flash Thompson, to be with Peter. So, you know, while the old Parker luck is still in effect in some areas, his love life does not appear to be one of those. He's got numerous prospects. Yes, there's still some melodrama and whatnot, but he's not as devoid of female attention as he once was. But Betty herself plays a major role in this story as, kind of like Daredevil number 1, I felt like this one was something that was uncharacteristically dark for 1964. We see Betty Brant's brother, I'll say that four times fast, get shot on panel and die. And it's like, you know, it definitely feeds into that Peter Parker guilt complex that he has. But I thought it was a really well done story. What were you guys' impressions of this one? Starting with you, Russell.
I was a bit jarred by the whole Betty Brant development because we didn't get to read a lot of those issues, so I'm kind of right there with you on that. But I also kind of kicked myself for not just reading them on my own because, by God, Amazing Spider-Man is still my favorite of these books. It is absolutely one of the best things you're ever going to read as far as like early 60s. Those Silver Age comics, this is, I think, Silver Age comics at their peak best.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing Spider-Man 11, as you pointed out, I think correctly, this is super dark and gritty for the time period. The whole premise of Doc Ock having served his sentence and getting out of jail is something that, you know, you might not really expect for a super villain, but they do it. They fully commit to the idea that he has served his time. He gets time off for good behavior, which was all part of his plan. Behave oneself in prison, serve your time for whatever it is, and they let you out. And the whole gambling debt angle with Betty's brother, I thought was a much more like Doc Ock is just kind of there to serve the supervillain role mm-hmm. for the story. But the meat is an old Blucky's gambling debt plan that Betty finds herself caught up in because they are recruiting, like they're using her to transport Doc Ock after her brother recruits him to help break out his old bookie from prison. Otherwise, he's going to wind up getting killed. Now, of course, all of this, you know, as you might imagine, dealing with gambling bookies, it goes south real fast. And I found this to be incredibly sophisticated storytelling for what it is. Because Spider-Man is a book that's been aimed at kids this whole time, though it is aimed at a group of kids that are maybe a little bit smarter than your average bear or whatever for this time. And despite a little bit of dated dialogue through the issue, but there's – I found not a ton of it really. This could easily hold up in the modern era. But man, this version of Doc Ock still continues to be fully realized. He is the version of Doc Ock you've always known. And it's incredible to me that Stan and Steve created this character so fully formed from the jump. And he continues to be this very compelling style character, even whenever he's playing more of an ancillary role to the main plot of this book. Peter finds himself in a tough situation because he's also struggling with the idea of, do I tell Betty who I am? I feel very like he's worried sick about her because she's disappeared and he doesn't know what's happened to her. And it's only later that we've, you know, when we see her helping to transport Doc Ock that we see what has actually happened. But yeah, that's where I think this book became really intelligent. It always has been, but this, like Daredevil, played with storytelling tropes that people probably weren't used to seeing in superhero comics, and probably exposed kids to some new ideas and like some new places where you could take these characters, make them more interesting, and put them in situations that they probably weren't thinking of at the time. So really, there's only one word I can think to refer to it as, and that's genius. So Amazing Spider-Man 11. In the running for my top favorite issue of this year.
Yeah, it's up there for me as well. I don't know where it'll, you know, I have a bit of an internal debate that I'm going with that we'll talk about a little bit later on. But, Tim, what were your thoughts on this one? Were you as into the whole organized crime aspect of this as Russell and I were? It kind of was a nice parallel with Daredevil number one, which is the other issue I kind of compared it to, just because not really, I mean, yes, Doc Ock is in it, but, you know, this more complex threat of the mob is really what we're looking at here, as opposed to a costumed supervillain.
Yes, absolutely. I thought that the stuff with Betty and her ain't shit brother and his gambling debt and all that stuff felt very, I don't know, sort of film noir. And
yeah,
then you just throw in some superheroes. you got Spider-Man and Doc Ock sort of on the fringes of this, and it actually works surprisingly well. It takes you out of the normal setting that you would expect of New York, so that was kind of a you know, throwing another obstacle in Spider-Man's path as this hero who's still learning the ropes, right? And we do get what I thought was a really fun sequence where he basically slips on a banana peel, right? And he twists his ankle. And you just don't see that kind of thing in superhero comics. But it's that reminder of this guy's very new at the job. And he's going to make mistakes like this. You know, shit's going to happen. And he does a nice job of selling the ankle throughout the rest of the issue, which I appreciated. Of course, you also get the creation of his spider tracer, which he uses to track the car that Betty makes her kind of getaway in. Now, I think you guys are going to have to help me out a little bit here with Betty Brant. Is she – so they're dating, and I get that, and she is Jonah's assistant,
yep.
Secretary. Mm-hmm. Is she meant to be a little bit older than him?
Yes.
Or?
Yes. By a little bit, because I went through and I read a lot of Amazing Spider-Man a few years back, and there's actually a scene at one point where Aunt May goes to the Bugle to tell Betty Brant that she needs to leave Peter alone because she's too old for him, which they recreated in Spectacular Spider-Man, the animated series. Now, granted, the age difference between Betty and Peter in Spectacular Spider-Man is a little bit larger than I think it was supposed to be here. I get the impression it's like maybe 3 to 4 years, somewhere in that mm-hmm. Realm, to where Peter is definitely, like you said, senior in high school, as he makes reference to in some of these 1964 issues, and Betty is obviously out in the workforce and stuff. So I don't, you know, they never put exact numbers on a lot of these things. We had this debate last episode about the age of Janet Van Dyne. So I'm going to say Peter is 17, 18, and Betty is 20, 21, maybe even 22.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And it also bears pointing out that, just to put this out there, for a lot of you folks that say that you hate the romance or you don't think that that's ever supposed to be part of your superhero comics, that's not why you read them, you guys really shouldn't read this early Stan and Steve Amazing Spider-Man run, because that's a pretty fucking huge bit of it. Mm-hmm. And this relationship between Betty and Peter, this, and I hate to say this, but this might be the most progressive representation of women so far in the current Marvel U, because Betty is written like a genuine person. She has a genuine gripe with Peter, and she's making some tough choices for herself to not get sucked back into this crazy world. And of course, Peter is over here struggling with the idea of whether or not he should come fully clean with Betty about him being Spider-Man, and that he blames himself for where their relationship has gotten to, but he knows that he still has these really strong feelings for her and doesn't want this relationship to just, you know, fade away or just to end. So really complex stuff going on in the background of everything that, that's been going on, throughout, this entire, relationship and this entire series, once they really started becoming a couple.
We also get a panel of the half Peter Parker, half Spider-Man face as he is contemplating telling her his secret, which that always tickled me in these older issues.
I always dug that, and I'm it's really cool to see that that was a thing very early on, and that that Steve Ditko is the guy who did it first.
Mm-hmm. Well, Todd, you know, Tim and Russell and I have all had a lot about this issue, but you haven't really had a chance to chime in. What were your thoughts on this one? Were you as taken by the tone of it as I was?
Peter Parker is a player. If you are 17, 18, and you're able to pull a 20 college age or mm-hmm. workforce age girl, God bless you, son. So
he ain't a player. He just swing a lot.
Yeah. Mm. He's come a long way. I mean, I don't know if Stan is. Stands into these inter-office relationships.
Yes.
It just is. You know, you date who you work with, apparently, in Stan's world. So I think Stan was into Flo Steinberg, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Because she was the girl Friday in the Marvel offices.
Yes.
No offense to Stan's wife. But no. So this was classic Spider-Man. You know, he's presented with the option that, well, I could do the right thing, but it's going to hurt me personally. And it does every issue. Every time he has to make this choice, it ends up affecting his personal bottom line. So this is classic vintage Spider-Man. Doc Ock is a fantastic villain, but it's kind of linked to the mob, which is a real world thing. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if Stan's brother Larry was in debt here. And so this is him projecting.
I'm sorry. I don't know why that.
Bennett Brandt / Larry Lieber, much older, right? So yeah. I don't know. I'm being silly here. I also will take away from this excellent issue that Doc Ock is smoking with one of his robot octopus arms.
Yes, which is
holding
awesome.
The cigarette.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
It really is. It really is.
I would do that.
There's all kinds of things I would do with a with metal arms, none of which are appropriate for these airwaves. But with that being said, let's jump over to another issue of Amazing Spider-Man, and this one I felt like wasn't as good as issue 11, but I think it's inarguably more historically significant because it provides the debut of the character that has kind of become Spider-Man's most iconic villain, that of course being the Green Goblin. And here to say only the Green Goblin, because they take the interesting approach of introducing us to the Green Goblin here, and there is no Norman Osborn to speak of in the pages of Amazing Spider-Man just yet. So a little bit of an interesting approach, and one that I remember when I first read that issue that we'll get to a couple of years down the road, where they made that reveal, I was kind of underwhelmed by it just because Norman Osborn hadn't been a major part of the book to that point. But anyway, here we get the Green Goblin, and yet again, another wacky fake movie plot from Stan Lee. I don't know what his deal was.
They not learn their lesson.
Yeah, with the fake movie plot, you kind of get Fantastic Four number 9 all over again here, just with Spider-Man and the Green Goblin. And if that's not enough, they had to shoot this fake movie just coincidentally at a cave where the Incredible Hulk just happens to be hiding out. And it doesn't really make any sense in the context of the story. Guys, I know this is important because it's the first appearance of Gobby, but this is kind of bad. Like, kind of the only bad Amazing Spider-Man we've read so far.
Yep, and that was... look, I'm just going to go ahead and say it so that everyone understands this. Green Goblin is the greatest Spider-Man foe of all time. There is... And it's a stacked field in there, but he really is. Norman Osborn, Green Goblin, that is the iconic villain. That said, this debut is ludicrously dumb. His scheme is some seriously cheesy, even for the time, convoluted bullshit. I mean, talk about being reliant on luck for all of this to work, as Nick alluded to. Just so happens the Hulk shows up in this because of course he fucking does. And, I mean, you know what? Amazing Spider-Man has made a lot of progress up to now. Solid issue after solid issue. But now the dialogue even reverts back to being this overly sincere and declarative format. This is just a bad issue in an otherwise string of great quality. So that's really all I can say for it, is that this was a real turd, and even Ditko's art is not that great here. Amazing Spider-Man 14, if not for the debut of Green Goblin, this is a snooze fest. It's a total skip. Incredible Hulk's inclusion makes no sense whatsoever. It's an out of nowhere bunch of idiocy. But we all know that the future Green Goblin appearances will be much better than this.
Start to write that character, yeah.
Yeah. Like once they really start to develop that, once they actually have a character for him, and my God, I can't tell you how much I hate the broomstick.
Oh. Yeah, I was about to bring that up. Like, you know,
I hate it so much. It's like they were going to make a witch character, and at the last minute, Stan decided, wait a minute, that might be goblin. Just a little dumb for this, so let's make him a goblin instead. And I'm like, okay, that's fine.
It's been really remarkable to me, you know, across the course of this project. I mean, yeah, you have things like the Iron Man armor has kind of been iterated, and they're getting closer to what we, you know, recognize as the classic Iron Man armor design. Daredevil's the same way. But a lot of these character designs kind of spring... At least from an aesthetic standpoint, pretty fully formed from the jump, especially over in the piece of Spider-Man. But Green Goblin here, while the Goblin himself is pretty much the iconic design that would last for decades, that broomstick man is a bad look. And it, you know, when they eventually decided to ditch that and go to the glider, that helped a lot, I think.
Well, yes. I'm just glad. Oh, go ahead, Tim.
I was just going to say, this issue is goofy as shit, and it feels like...
But not even in that fun, like, Fantastic Four way. It's just...
It's really not.
Uninteresting, you know?
You know what? It feels like it's overbooked. It's like, you've got way too much shit going on here. You've got the Green Goblin, his first appearance. Okay, great. Then you've got the movie producer plot, which has no business in the book at this point. The Enforcers are brought back.
The Enforcers!
Yeah.
The Hulk makes his appearance. Just all this shit going on at the same time. And there's even, like, kind of some good fight scenes with splitting the Enforcers and the Hulk, but none of it really gels. And so, I mean, in the Green Goblin, when you think about it, he's kind of barely in the issue. So it's just, I don't know what happened here, but... Way, way misfire.
I agree. Todd?
Well, let's just be thankful that they didn't introduce Harry or Norman Osborn in the same issue.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because then, you know, that's one of my pet peeves, is that the villain's identity is introduced in the same story arc, or the solution to the villain You know, like this past season of Flash where, well, it took the villain's wife who we'd never met to ultimately vanquish the villain. Well, I want our heroes to do it. So I just wish that this issue, although it introduces the Green Goblin, I wish the issue was a little bit more memorable other than him looking creepy. And I can't read the Enforcers, who previously appeared in some earlier Spider-Man episodes, without thinking, Fancy Dan sounds like Captain Metropolis, every line of dialogue he says. So I will throw that bone out there.
I look forward to hearing the response and hearing the response to the response. So I think we've kind of sufficiently shat on Amazing Spider-Man 14. So let's move on to something that I don't think we're going to shit on, or at least I know I'm not, because finally, after an entire episode away, Journey into Mystery, we get that back on the reading list here with issue 108. And I got to be honest, I'm not entirely sure why this is on the list and some of the earlier Journey into Mystery stuff was not, because here we kind of see, you know, another Loki story. It's a fine Loki story, don't get me wrong, but the only thing I can think is perhaps it's on here because we start to see, you know, more crossover between Thor and the rest of the Marvel Universe. We see Doctor Strange make a cameo. We see some of the evolution of the Thor and Odin conflict in terms of both of them trying to, you know, Thor trying to assert his independence and Odin trying to exert control over his most favored son. But yeah, so we get a plot here with Loki coming back to Earth, stealing Donald Blake's cane and trying to basically torture him by kidnapping Jane Foster. And by the end of it, it's a pretty straightforward Thor and Loki story, although it's drawn beautifully by Jack Kirby. You can really tell that Jack just loved doing Thor. But what's really notable about this, and I know the quality of it wasn't that great, but, you know, Journey into Mystery had a history of being an anthology title. And here they kind of maintain that format, but they do it in a really cool way. Because the last five pages of this book are a Tales of Asgard. And I know for you guys, this probably didn't play as well as it did for me, but the very concept of Tales of Asgard, especially early on in the Marvel Universe, kind of encapsulates what I love so much about Thor and over at DC, Green Lantern, because both of the mythos, I don't know what the proper plural form would be, but anyway, the thing that's really remarkable about them to me is that they are capable of being so expansive. So you have Thor in this main title, but then the very existence of Tales of Asgard shows you there is an entire universe, hundreds of characters and concepts that really flesh out what makes Thor such a cool idea in the Marvel Universe. So while I can't say that anything in this issue blew me away, I dug what they were starting to do with Thor and his supporting characters from a conceptual standpoint. What about you, Todd?
Here you are. I noticed that you are lame also.
Yes.
Loki pretending and throwing away Don Blake's walking stick. No, I thought this was not bad.
Yeah.
Enjoyed the crossover aspects. It's always cool when you get to see Kirby draw a Ditko character and vice versa, where Ditko would draw Kirby characters, Avengers, in Spider-Man and so on. So this issue was pretty cool. I think we really see the father issues starting to happen with Thor here. What makes him a little bit more unique, this rebellious almost teenager compared to some of the other characters. He's not even a teenager, but were I a teenager reading comics at this point, I might see that aspect between Thor and Odin. So I you know, Loki's always been one of my favorite villains, and I enjoy the way he is extra, extra treacherous here. This issue is not without comedy. And who's the random Asgardian who carries Loki back to Asgard?
Yeah,
and
unnamed.
Unnamed old man sidekick henchman.
Has an awesome Wilford Brimley mustache, though.
Yes, yes. I thought it was true. Also, Loki tricking Thor into falling into a hole, quite literally, was awesome.
Yes.
But, you know, this is a good example of the Thor stories of the time, building on the Asgardian mythos. And I think it might be important for the supplemental material afterwards too, because that's still Kirby. That's probably more Kirby than anything else, and Stan just put words on it. You definitely have the super detailed, sometimes to a fault, Coletta inks on it too. So yeah, I'm glad we get another Thor solo story. I guess it's noted because of the Doctor Strange crossover and seeing him finally, maybe the popularity of Strange. We haven't seen him cross over to anything else at this point, I don't believe. I know he goes into Spidey pretty soon, but coming over. So yeah, good issue, and more four color excitement from the team Kirby and Lee here.
Yeah, I had that sequence between the lame Dr. Donald Blake and the lame old man in his waiting room.
Oh, that killed me.
Having the lame off, that was a total standout, and yeah, it really took me out.
I too am lame.
So that one worked on both of us. I was a little bit curious. So we get the Doctor Strange appearance, the crossover, which I would agree is probably what makes this notable. Just you get to see how, because that was something we talked about before, right? How Doctor Strange felt very isolated from the rest of the Marvel
universe. He's a weirdo.
He's a weirdo. And how do you work him into other kinds of stories and perhaps interact with other heroes? And this was a pretty effective way to do it. Pairing him up with somebody like Thor, who's not similar to him in terms of the tone, but just kind of the types of stories you can do with those two characters. There is some intersection, I feel like. And it was a little bit strange. He goes down, right? He's injured, and lame Dr. Donald Blake is treating him. What kind of operation are they doing on this guy who seems just to be fatigued from the looks of it? I mean, I was a little bit thrown by, you know, he's in surgery, basically. So what are they doing to him?
No one knows.
So that was somewhat odd, but it does put Doctor Strange in Thor's debt, which they pay off pretty nicely towards the end of this book. I was it was surprising to me that the conflict here between Thor and Odin was resolved by the end of this issue. I mean, certainly that will rear its head again.
No, constantly throughout yes. The first like 15 years of Thor stories. Yes.
Yes, but I thought they might leave that one hanging, you know, but they do draw a line under it, such as it is in this comic.
And you want to talk about Kirby art? I'm sorry, but I'm just glancing through the title of the book again. The top panel of page 6, if you guys are looking at it right now, with the planets in the background and the Rainbow Bridge and Asgard, like, not overly detailed, but just the concept right there is mind-blowing to me, and it's clear that Kirby had a hard-on for this stuff.
There is such an energy to his pencils on Thor in a way that you don't get on other books.
No, you don't.
I know we've said it before, but it has to be seen to be understood. It crackles. You know, it's the Kirby crackle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you really see that on this book. It's terrific.
Russell, I don't think we've given you an opportunity to weigh in on Journey into Mystery 108.
I'm gonna be that guy. Not in terms of not liking the issue. I actually really did like this issue. I found it to be a lot of fun, but if a bit silly. But there's one thing that it sticks in my craw, and this is a total fanboy moment. How the fuck did those people lift that cane or his stick if that was Mjolnir?
Because it wasn't Mjolnir.
It is.
But it's not.
But it is.
Right. It is. Like, it is. Early.
And a couple of bums are using it as a fishing pole. Right. And I'm sitting over here like, so the secret to lifting.
They're worthy bums.
Apparently.
It's not Mjolnir until it turns into Mjolnir. When it's a cane, it's just a cane. Because there was
I don't think that they can tap it and turn into Thor
right.
either.
Right. That
I
is.
Think,
That is
accurate. Does not work for them.
I have read all of these early Thor stories, like literally every one, and there are various points where you will see Jane Foster like bring him the cane and stuff like that. Which, hey, there's
however, Jane,
a little bit of foreshadowing.
Worthy.
Yes, granted, but I don't think that Stan Lee was planning out Jason Aaron's Thor run in 1962 through 1965.
Ah, but you're wrong, true believer.
I'm just saying, like, that's isn't not something how, to get hung up on, I don't think.
But isn't it great how modern writers like Jason Aaron and Brian Michael Bendis will look back at some of these old stories and mold them in that way? That's something that I've really gained some appreciation for by going back and reading this stuff. And to Tim's point, in the new episode of Marvel Masterclass, which you can go listen to right now or after you finish this this podcast, no, it might not have been Stan and Jack's original intent on Iceman. I agree with that, but I love how Bendis played it. So that's that's what I truly meant by my statement, is that maybe it wasn't necessarily meant that way at the time, but I love the way it was played. And as
this
far
is,
as this
is not the rebuttal show to a rebuttal show, for the record.
But I get my moments in where I can. But Thor and Doc Strange together, that's just natural pairing. That just makes all the sense in the world to me.
It does, yeah.
I do feel a little bit let down by this this bit, because it felt like Doc Strange really could have been subbed out for any character who had his particular skill set. It's just one of those weird things where I was expecting a little bit more out of their first like real team up, though I thought that it really sang at the end. I loved what I loved how he played it or played against Loki at the end, and how Loki was having such a hard time dealing with him.
What's crazy is, you know, you talk about Thor and Doctor Strange being such a natural pairing.
Yes,
there's really not that much of it in Thor's publication history. Like, you might get some of it in stuff like you might see Doctor Strange occasionally cross over with the Avengers and get some interaction with those two there. Or even much later on, whenever they have Valkyrie on Defenders, you'll occasionally see Thor have interactions with him there. But for it to be such a natural pairing of concepts, they really don't have a deep connection to each other, at least from a Thor-specific story standpoint.
No, they don't. And that's something that I've I guess we're going to, you know, discuss more as we go along, but that's something that I really do want to see more of now. I mean, this little short tease mm-hmm. of them together kind of whet my appetite for some Doc Strange and Thor team up, because it really reminded me a lot of that their great team up pairing, brief as it is, in Thor Ragnarok. Yeah, like it set my mind to that, thinking,
I thought so too.
Yeah, I was like, this makes all the sense in the world to put Doc Strange and Thor in the same story. And to have Doc Strange giving Loki all sorts of headaches because it's entertaining as hell. Mm-hmm. So the more of that I can get, the better. And there's plenty of fun bits in here of Doc Strange just fucking with Loki. So if you're, you know, into that like I am, go do it. Go get on this issue. It's a lot of fun. I'm going to just go ahead and put it out there, because Nick is going to disagree with me here. That backup story is useless.
I disagree.
Oh,
I know you
oh,
do.
Oh, wow.
I read it and was like, I just don't give a shit. So,
and I will rebut by saying that somebody could easily pick up an issue of Tales of the Sinestro Corps from the Sinestro Corps War, read about these characters that they don't really care about, and say the exact same thing.
And maybe so. Maybe so. But this did nothing for me as far as this issue went. The main tale, I was all in for. Loved reading it. Thought the artwork was great. The backup story, art was fine. Art was good in places. I guess it served as an introduction to the trolls and to that side of Thor's mythology. But as far as a story for me, as I was reading it, I found myself just trying to skim and get to the end of it. I did not care. So main feature, I'm good on. Love it. Backup feature, whatever.
The backup feature also starts to introduce that concept of young Thor and the stories that he's been on, the adventures that he's been on, implying this very deep and extensive backstory and history that we will see played out over many years, and also set up that template of featuring multiple versions of Thor across the timeline in various stories, something that we still see playing a major role in Thor comics to this day. But
I love that Jason Aaron just did it better.
Well, yeah, but
what
I mean,
that's 1964.
What do you want? You know that Jeff Johns did Green Lantern better than Gil Kane. Like, what are we? What is our baseline for comparison here?
Can you tell that I've really gotten under Nick and Todd's skin with this, because I'm having a blast doing it.
I mean, it's not under my skin so much as you're it's just silly.
I think there is value to the Tales of Asgard concept in terms of doing that kind of world building, even if this particular installment might not be the best in the world.
And see, that's a good point, because like, I think my praise of it is, I don't think this is the first one, although it might be. Todd, you could probably help me out. My memory's a little fuzzy at this point. But it's the first one on our reading list, and I think the concept of Tales of Asgard is something that you're not seeing anywhere else in the Marvel Universe, and not really seeing anywhere else in comics to this point, where you're getting expansive world building for one single character. And so I guess that's kind of where I'm coming at it from on this one.
It would be like in Daredevil having from the casebook of Nelson and Murdoch, you know, it's fleshing out this world that's just too big for one issue a month. That's all.
I absolutely agree. Thank you, Todd. But we're going to move on now and get back to Avengers, because Avengers number 4 was not the only Avengers title on our list for this episode. We also took a look at Avengers number 8, which features the debut of one of the most iconic Avengers villains of them all. That, of course, being Kang the Conqueror, as played by Andrew Lincoln. So, guys, here's where I'm going to probably deviate from everybody else. And I'm going to throw it out there right now. I have never liked Kang the Conqueror, like in pretty much anything I've ever read. Now, granted, I have not read a lot of the iconic, you know, the big Kang stories. I'm thinking of one that I can't remember the name of.
Avengers Forever is probably my favorite one.
Avengers Forever. I've never read.
Kirk Busiek series. That's really good. Yep. Carlos Pacheco. Kang.
You need a doctorate in Avengers continuity, though, to really enjoy Avengers Forever, was my experience.
Right. So, you know, I was coming into this one, I was hoping that maybe it could change my mind a little bit on Kang and get me to warm up to him somewhat. And I got to say, not so much here. I mean, the art's good, but I just don't care about this character. Russell, there's my one where we're going to be on opposite sides. So I'll let you go ahead and rebut that.
Speaking of silly opinions, there's one now.
I'll own that. I know that I'm in the minority when it comes to Kang. Like, I get it. He is a huge, important Marvel villain, and I have just never cared about anything involving him.
I'll go ahead and say that Kang's whole being the weird time traveler from Fantastic Four earlier totally redeemed the character in my eyes, because I really liked what they did with him here. He has this just great imposing way about him. And as he takes on the Avengers, up to now we've seen them like come together pretty easily and take out characters not unlike Kang. But Kang's future tech and his knowledge of how they operate allows him to take down the core members of the Avengers pretty easily. And not only that, he kind of wipes out their powers using future tech. And I thought this was a great little bit of plotting. So having not read a ton of Kang stories myself, this one here, at least for its first two acts, really endeared the character to me and made me think this guy is, you know, maybe he is a future version of Doom. Or maybe the equivalent of it. I don't think he's the man himself, but yeah, he is totally a great Avengers villain for my money. He doesn't pontificate quite in the way Doom does, and his brains don't go into his ass whenever he runs across like Captain America or Ant-Man or something like that. He stays focused. He stays on message. The only time he does something that seems odd or like truly dumb is when the team brigade shows up and acts like, "Oh, we've seen the light. We've seen it your way. We've come here to serve you." And his first inclination is, "Hey, that's cool. Why don't you go on inside my ship and have a look around at everything? Yeah, I'm totally trusting you." Although later, in the same issue, he does say that he's watching them constantly, like he's got them under constant surveillance. So, okay, fair enough. But again, the Team Brigade ruins everything. Mm-hmm. If you were to update this for, say, the modern era and put it in the MCU, you could replace the Team Brigade with the Champions, and I think you'd have a better story. But Wasp actually gets a minute to shine here because it's her plan that helps to free the Avengers. She's the only one of the core group that doesn't wind up trapped in the ship. So she comes up with this pretty ingenious plan of getting them all out.
True.
And that's...
But also has a really bad, cringeworthy line of dialogue.
Oh, yes. Yes, she does. Whenever she sees Kang the first time, she thinks to herself, she doesn't say it, but she thinks it, "I bet he's handsome under that mask." Once again, Stan, I guess in this issue, it would be two steps forward, one step back. Because that's the only, like, really, like, super cringy moment for me in the book. Though it is super cringy. It's a bit rushed there at the end because, once again, this is another one of those very compressed style storytelling issues where they introduce this really great big bad character who, complex as hell, is somebody that kind of has the Avengers and the U.S. military just stumped, and he's defeated just a little too easily there at the end, I thought. But other than that, really... well done issue, some outstanding artwork for my money. I really had a great time reading this. Love the team dynamic of the Avengers. Kang is now one of my villains to watch as we go forward. So Avengers number 8, finally an issue of this book that I genuinely had a great time reading. So, and one that makes me have a lot of hope for the series going forward because they've got some big ideas in there.
Absolutely. Yeah, I thought this was good for Avengers comics, for early Avengers comics. Kang is an interesting case because, I mean, I am kind of a big Avengers guy, and I would say their rogues gallery is a little bit similar to Superman's in that they aren't the greatest. There aren't a lot that really stand out. But Kang is in that upper echelon of Avengers villains. It's just, he always feels like he's missing a hook as a character. I mean, how do you really describe the guy as anything other than a walking continuity nightmare?
In the best possible way, though.
I suppose. It's just trying to describe his personality, his motivations. I mean, it's a little bit flimsy. Even having read quite a bit of Kang material, I don't know. What do you think, Todd?
I think Kang is too big of a character for Stan Lee to write in an interesting manner. I think you need to have a science fiction type writer or, nobody, you didn't have Alan Moore in 1964, but you had guys like Ray Bradbury. I think if you're going to go play the time card, you need to really make something interesting come out of it because, time travel was even a cliche in the mid 60s. As far as in comic stories, they've done it in their anthology tales and things like that quite a bit already. So if you're going to do something, you need to give it more of a unique slant. And Kang's just a little bit aloof, and yes, he's got the future tech, but why? But why, Kang? Why? So I think it just outmatched Stan and what he was capable of doing. I'm not nuts about the character's design. I'm not opposed to the character being a foil for the Avengers, but I need to know more. And even the character has been handled better by modern writers, but still, I don't think he... I think Avengers, I don't necessarily think Kang is the guy. I think Ultron is the guy, and we don't see him for a long, long time.
Yeah, we're a ways away from that. Can we also just say here, you know, I know it's not going to happen anytime soon, but I am so ready for the Teen Brigade to not be a thing anymore. Like,
yes,
the Teen Brigade taking the action here and going, we're going to go, somebody has to do it. Somebody has to save the Avengers. You know, them taking on that that role just irked the hell out of me. I'm sick to death of these fuckers.
It's got to stop.
Fully with you there. It's just some dumb as hell bullshit. Mm-hmm. So yes, I fully agree that needs to happen. We need to get rid of the Teen Brigade just as soon as we possibly fucking can.
To include Rick Jones, like,
yeah,
you know. Now, granted, we know that's not happening anytime soon, because that fucker is like a cockroach. You just can't kill him at this point.
I was thinking, you know, this is an aside, but tied into the Avengers through the Hulk, my first exposure to Rick Jones was from the 1982 Hulk cartoon, which ran concurrently with Spider-Man and his amazing friends. I don't know if any of you have seen said cartoon, but Rick Jones is there with a cowboy hat and a guitar in every goddamn episode. So
cowboy hat and a guitar?
And a guitar, blonde hair. Yeah, he looks like something from Real World Season 2. So if you can find...
That's a version of Rick Jones I could get behind.
Yeah, it's not classic country, Nick. It's new country Rick Jones.
Ooh.
1982, you know, due to my age, classifies as classic country. I know for you it's a little bit later in the pantheon, but that's just where we are.
Just the good old boys. All right, so
there we go.
Anyway, I was thinking I actually have a connection with Rick Jones for over 35 years at this point, which is crazy. Just crazy. He wasn't handled well as a character, in my opinion, until Peter David's Captain Marvel series, who I don't know if anybody of it on this panel has read, but that, and I know Ben has read that. That's a great... Oh, and actually, Peter David must see something in Rick Jones, because he used him pretty well in the Hulk run that Peter did in late 80s, early 90s. That was pretty iconic. So,
and it was pretty cool that he also had Rick Jones in his Miles Morales run. So that, you know, it just goes all comes full circle, I think.
Yeah, and when he did John Byrne's Next Men as well.
Yes.
So
Jesus.
Oh.
Anywho, we are true to ourselves. No. Moving on.
Rails, we off them.
Oh, man. Okay, let's get back on the rails here a little bit. And so while Russell and I have disagreed a little bit on the last two books that we've talked about, I don't think we're going to disagree very much on this next entry, because we hop back over to Amazing Spider-Man and we take a look at two issues. And they really could not be any more different from one another in terms of a plot and story structure. So first we're going to talk about the Amazing Spider-Man Annual Number One. And much like Fantastic Four Annual Number One from a last episode in 1963, completely changed the game and redefined epic storytelling for the Fantastic Four, Amazing Spider-Man Annual Number One kind of comes along and does the exact same thing for action-focused Spider-Man stories. Introducing the Sinister Six, giving Spider-Man a physical threat that he hasn't really had to face anything like in the past, and even introducing that story element of Peter's powers being tied to his emotion and how they can kind of fail him when his self-confidence is starting to wane a little bit is really interesting. And so, you know, it clocks in at a hefty 72 pages. About 40 to 41 of those are the actual main feature, and the rest of it being supplemental material, kind of like Fantastic Four Annual Number One, where you get diagrams of Peter's house, you get pinup pages of all the villains, you get a splash page of the Daily Bugle with Betty Brant and J. Jonah Jameson and stuff like that. But these annuals, these early Marvel annuals, have just been revelations to me across the board to this point. So I loved Annual Number One. Ditko was on fire. And I know, Russell, you're chomping at the bit to specifically talk about There's one art device that Ditko uses throughout the structure of the story that you were really impressed by.
I absolutely loved this debut of the Sinister Six. Yeah. This is like the villain team for Amazing Spider-Man, for Spider-Man in general. Like, throughout his history, this is a team that always comes back. Membership changes ever so slightly, but this core group that you see here of Vulture, Kraven, Electro, Sandman, Doc Ock, and who am I forgetting?
Mysterio.
Mysterio, yes. This core six is the villain team. We've had classic issues with each of these characters leading up to now, mm-hmm. and I absolutely loved seeing this team up. This is actually the first time I've ever read the classic team up of these characters, and it was as good as I could have hoped for it to be.
Now, Russell, imagine if somehow you could take the Sinister Six and work in Norman Osborn's head in a jar into the equation, and think how good it would be then.
Oscar worthy. Or Eisner worthy, excuse me, if that wasn't a thing at this time. But yes, we're on fire there, especially if if I read him in Dane DeHaan voice the entire time. Yeah, if we want to really take it there. But in any case, the part that you alluded to that I absolutely loved was Steve Ditko had Spider-Man fight each of the individual members of the Six. Through like their own little series of pages. So you get Spider-Man taking them down in a unique way for each one. But he always got to deliver kind of a coup de grace punch or kick to each of the members at the end of the fight. And Ditko took great care to illustrate that in maybe the most beautiful way possible by giving that moment its own whole page. And it's poster worthy. Every one of them is absolutely gorgeous. I can't pick a favorite because I want all of them kind of lined side by side of Spider-Man taking out each individual member of the Six, because it's done just so beautifully. I mean, we praise Kirby a lot through this, and maybe he really did have the best overall work of the year, but shit, man, you can't tell me that this isn't just jaw-dropping whenever you see it.
Oh, it's amazing. Like, it's, so much of our talk about Ditko to this point has been based on his facial structures and his emotion through his storytelling, and we've kind of undersold him as an action artist a little bit, but here, he absolutely delivers, in my opinion.
It was my favorite work I've seen of him so far. Yeah. This is Ditko firing all cylinders, height of his power, just nailing it. And I mean, it's classic Spider-Man stuff. If you can't look at this and just be enthralled or even engorged, maybe check your pulse, because I worry for you. This is the kind of comics that you hope to see. And man, the folks who bought this issue whenever it came out, if you've held this and you've got it in good shape, my God, you've got just some of the best artwork that's ever been committed to the comic page. This is an all-timer, and an all-timer issue for me. This is kind of a defining moment for the mythos that truly makes me a comic book fan. So there you are.
So Russell and I have filibustered long enough. Todd, I'm dying to hear your take on this one, because you've been a big fan of Ditko's artwork up to this point, much like we have, and this kind of feels like just an evolution for him in such a big way.
Spoiler alert! Sorry for shouting. This is the best comic that was produced in 1964, in my opinion. Not only do you have just this awesome tale of villains getting together and combining their forces and trying to outsmart Spider-Man, and Stan realizing what he had in each of these villains and how they could work together, you had more of a look into the day-to-day life of Peter Parker than you had. You know, usually they're trying to rush through things, and you have the formula of Flash picking on him and Aunt May being sad and Peter being stuck with money problems and stuff at the Bugle. But this gets everything into a little bit deeper look at everything, all the status quo of Peter Parker. And I got to tell you, it's just so much fun. It's like everything breathes for just a second. It's almost a Spider-Man movie before you had a Spider-Man movie. Plus, like Russell said, where you had just the build-ups of the individual unlabeled chapters of Spider-Man fighting each individual villain and then culminating in the splash pages, or the not splash pages, but the single panel pages where Spider-Man would vanquish his foe, you also had some of the funniest and most shameless plugs for other Marvel books all throughout this first half of the book, with Spider-Man interacting with Thor, or at least passing by Thor, Doctor Strange foiling the bullies, Spider-Man having an opportunity to be saved by the Fantastic Four, and they don't choose to save him. The Avengers, or at least Giant Man and the Wasp, kind of stealing the thunder. It's just a great, fantastic issue, and like to me, it's very parallel to the Fantastic Four issue from 1963. You get this culmination of things that you're not just writing to the single issue. Stan is building on things and looking long term, and I just love comparing that, especially to say some of the DC stuff where you were not getting that. You would get you know, callbacks and characters returning and trying a different plan, but you wouldn't have something pay off issues later like you would here. So yeah, just more evolution. It's a mystery where there's so many great things happening in one comic book. And again, my favorite comic of 1964. And I don't know, Electro, this is the first time we have seen Electro. What do you guys think about Electro's headgear and his costume?
I love Electro's costume. It's ridiculous. But
it's love or hate,
like,
isn't it?
Yeah, I understand why people would hate it, but to me it's goofy, and it's one of those things that is very comic booky, for lack of a better term. Like, I understand why people can't take it seriously, but I like it. I like it a great deal, actually.
Yeah.
It makes me laugh, but I do love it because that's how I've always known Electro. I had never seen him done any other way, at least for a really long time.
Yeah, Byrne tried to redo it, but not like this.
Yeah. No. This classic look for Electro is one that, whenever I was a kid, no, it didn't come off as silly to me at all. It was a supervillain costume, and it said supervillain to me.
And neither did Mysterio, for that matter. There's always been one that
eyes on his shoulders.
Yeah. Like Mysterio is one that I never considered it goofy, and that's the thing I can say about a lot of Spider-Man villains. That even though, as a 36-year-old adult, I can look at now and say, yes, this is some pretty goofy stuff, but as a kid growing up, and then of course as a college age comic book reader, no, not even a little. I took every bit of that as this is their serious look, and it comes off as, you know, villain-esque and menacing. Electro's crazy out there, completely impractical mask included. So that I'm on board all the way.
Sorry,
go ahead, Todd.
I want to follow up on Ben's point of, you know, his rogues gallery are all kind of represent evil father figures or evil teacher figures. So Spider-Man is fighting his total faculty spiritually here, if not literally, because the lizard is not here. But, you know, this is youth wish fulfillment par excellence. You're taking on your science teacher. You're taking on your gym teacher. Doc Ock is your stupid vice principal. You know, I just admire what they're doing. But you go back through and look, and just the way Spider-Man interacts with all these other Marvel Universe characters, and then the editor's blurb. I mean, it's awesome and it's cheesy at the same point. But goddamn, the art is great.
This is the first title that like seems to pull in even just for cameos, every notable character in the Marvel Universe, and you finally start to see that, like, just how expansive this has become already. It is, it's impressive as hell. Todd, Russell, myself, we've all been very effusive in our praise for this issue. Tim, are you going to join us on this side of the line in the sand?
I liked this issue. I didn't love it, which okay. I know sounds like a scorching hot take.
Compared to what you've just heard.
Compared to the praise that you guys have heaped on.
Oh, is the subtitle to this called Infinity War or something?
Yes, this is Amazing Spider-Man Annual 1 Infinity War. I don't know. It just wasn't totally what I wanted out of a Spider-Man Sinister Six fight. I thought they were kind of dumb the way they went about it.
Yeah, and the staged approach as opposed to the all at once.
Well, yeah, and they all kind of go down a little too easily, it seems like. Mm-hmm. And I'm never a fan of the whole psychosomatic loss of powers thing. I don't really get it. It's just, I don't know. There's just something. Yes, the Ditko art, absolutely. Everything you guys have said and more, right there with you. I love those splash pages he throws in here. The story itself just felt a little perfunctory. I don't know. The climactic showdown with Doc Ock, where he dons scuba gear. I wailed. I'll just say, I had to walk away and come back to the comic.
Now imagine if Aunt May in this book had seen Doc Ock in his swimming trunks.
Yep.
Oh, we might have gotten some very interesting developments.
Or if robot octopus arms had flippers at the end.
Oh. Yes. Well, this is the beginning of the long, complicated relationship between Doc Ock and Aunt May, who, isn't that strange? She's so smitten with him, seems unaware of the fact that she is being held hostage.
That's because she's drawn like Mr. Magoo and can't see her surroundings. Like, she has no idea what's actually going on.
That's entirely possible. I mean, what does she think is happening? That, you know, she's just been abducted and taken to this place. Granted, no harm comes to her.
She doesn't get pupils till John Romita Sr. comes on the scene.
This is true. This is true.
Oh, God. That's true. That's true. I guess she just thinks she's out to tea with her... nephew's girlfriend or whatever is going on with Betty Brant here. So,
cameos. I had sort of a love-hate relationship with the cameos in this issue.
Really? Okay.
I mean, yeah, they are kind of charming. They are, I think, self-aware enough for being the cheap plugs that they are that they kind of get away with it. But at a certain point, you start to go, all right, well, when are we going to see the X-Men now? You know, it's like, can I just read the story, please?
So, yeah.
But I get it. I mean, I know why they're there and the purpose they serve. It's just, yeah, I don't know. It wasn't totally what I wanted it to be. We do get some backups in this annual as well that, I'll be honest, the one that was just basically about Spider-Man's powers and supporting cast and world, I didn't even really read. We get a diagram of Peter Parker's house in Forest Hills. How about that?
Here's a bedroom.
That was a parody of the Fantastic Four annual.
Tremendous. Here's the window he climbs in through at night. Yeah, that was pretty good stuff.
I'm not sure Aunt May has a bedroom. I don't think we saw one there.
She just sleeps in the chair,
she falls asleep while she's knitting.
She just sleeps in the recliner like the grandma from Bad Santa, and asks if she makes sandwiches and stuff. But Amazing Spider-Man Annual Number 1, we've said and reiterated so many times, is kind of this huge action epic. But the last issue on our Spider-Man on our list for the Spider-Man reading order really could not be any more different than that. Amazing Spider-Man number 18 is notable because there's barely any Spider-Man in it. It is a story almost entirely concerned with Peter Parker, with Liz Allen, with Betty Brant, and perhaps most notably with J. Jonah Jameson. Because what has happened here is in between issues here, so sometime between issue 14 and issue 18, so either in 15, 16, or 17, which weren't on our reading list, Aunt May has fallen ill, and Peter has to actually leave a fight with the Green Goblin to go to Aunt May's side. And the entire city basically sees this. They see Spider-Man running away from a fight, and his reputation is ruined by this. And J. Jonah Jameson acts like it is freaking Christmas in July when this happens. It is, he has never been happier, and he just has this massive,
it's
like shit-eating grin on his face the entire issue. And it is best. Amazing.
It's like Bobby Heenan at the end of Royal Rumble 92.
It is fantastic. But not just for the comedic elements of J. Jonah Jameson. I have to say, guys, like, you all know this about me. You know, my entry point to comics was Ultimate Spider-Man. And my favorite thing that what I always loved about that book was the way Brian Michael Bendis was able to make you care just as much, if not more, honestly, at most times, about what these characters were doing in their personal life as you did about the Spider-Man stuff. And so to go all the way back to 1964 and see an issue that concerns itself so much with Peter Parker and his relationships with all these people and treats Spider-Man as like this just kind of ancillary part to it, it spoke to me. Like, it is right in my wheelhouse. So I loved the hell out of this issue. I know I'm probably going to be the high man on it, but I'm willing to own that. Tim, what about you? Was this at least better than your experience with the annual?
Yeah, it kind of was. I dig this for being as different as it was, and I like the way that it really drove home the idea that being Spider-Man kind of sucks, and it is basically imposing limits on Peter Parker's life. You know, there are things that a high school senior should be and could be doing that he is not, because of what he sees as his responsibility and his obligations as Spider-Man. Not only that, with Aunt May being in the condition that she is, this is something I talked about a little bit with Ben, how Peter is kind of more the parent to her, and while she is very doting, he's like the breadwinner in this household. Mm-hmm. And now he's in the position of having to be primary caregiver as well, which is incredibly stressful for anyone in that scenario. But again, we're talking about a high school student. So just the weight of the world on this kid's shoulders, basically, you just want to see him get some good therapy, pretty much. I mean, for God's sake, all this going on, and so racked with tremendous guilt he is, because of what he sees as his role in Uncle Ben's death, that just the thought of it causes him to lose his superpowers, which we saw in the annual. My God, get yourself some help. This is not healthy. This is not a healthy way of coping. And, you know, it's just too much for one person. And that's just kind of the story of Peter Parker's life. You know, Parker luck, right? That's the saying. And this is the first issue where all of that kind of comes down. And, I mean, they even acknowledge it at the end. They're saying, yeah, we told you this was going to be a little bit different, a little bit offbeat for a Spider-Man comic, so let us know what you think. I am curious how this one went over with the then readership.
Yeah, that's a great question. Todd, how did it go over with you, at least?
Well, this is very different. Very, very different. I did enjoy it. It was rather funny looking at it from a bird's eye view 50 years later. Some of the little things, you know, Aunt May is so old and decrepit in her chair, and her medicine, what on earth is this medicine that's liquid and in a, you know, a pint sized bottle? What they don't get specific with her injury.
It's very expensive, whatever it is.
Yeah, but this arc, this issue-long arc of him just getting his stuff together enough that he can reclaim the mantle of Spider-Man and just get it done. He's he's just so preoccupied taking care of Aunt May. It's so unfair. But, you know, would you think as a kid in the 60s, you'd want to read about something that's really unfair? You don't. You want to read about somebody overcoming that. So they eventually get to that. But you relate. Again, relatable Peter Parker, relatable mm-hmm. Spider-Man. You know, they had done so much with this character to be so different, so unique, and they keep it up here where he's a coward, and they keep this more than just issue by issue. This is an arc that's stretching out. And you look at how the Avengers are reacting to it. You look at how the Fantastic Four are commenting on it. Human Torch can't believe it. He's trying to call out Spidey, his teenage contemporary, and talk it out. But at the end of the issue, you get this triumphant moment of Spider-Man saying, no, I'm going to pick myself up by my bootstraps. I'm going to get it done. So I do enjoy that quite a bit. The J. Jonah Jameson characterization is flat out the funniest thing we have seen. He's a one-note character, but it's fantastic and funny all the way throughout. And just imagine how much fun that must be to write, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great, great issue. Much more focused than the annual, which I still love. Maybe a little bit more because of the art, the iconic art mm-hmm. aspects. But yeah, this is fantastic. And imagine just how far they've come with these characters in just 3 years. Goodness gracious.
Absolutely. Russell, what were your thoughts on this one?
Hot take, this was better than the annual.
it's hard for me to, like, it's so hard to draw that distinction because it couldn't be any more different than the annual. You know, like,
I think that's why, for me, yeah. It is, because the annual gave me the great fun action silliness that I expect from Amazing, especially from early Amazing Spider-Man. But then this issue that came out right after the annual gives you that classic good old Parker look. As Tim pointed out, this issue is chock full of it, and it's at every conceivable angle in Spider-Man's life. He can't catch a break. It's one thing after another. Although you start to kind of wonder if the infinite pint bottle of medicine is really running as low as he says it is, considering every time he picks it up, he says the same thing. It's like, how many more doses are really left in there, Peter? But from his money troubles to the stress of trying to maintain being Spider-Man, dealing with Aunt May's injury or operation that she's had to have, the disintegration of his relationship with Betty Brant that he is just absolutely pining over. And then that moment where he sees how things have gone with Flash Thompson, how Flash Thompson seems to be the only person, ironically enough, the only person in the world who is still defending Spider-Man after just these scathing editorials by J. Jonah Jameson that have turned public opinion more towards his side of things. And you start to see the cracks in Peter's own mental state where this has really gotten to him. This has really pushed him to that point where at one point in the issue, he even takes his costume, wads it up in a bag, and tosses it in the trash, declares that he is done being Spider-Man, only to have Aunt May remind us that she's not just there to be another plot device for Peter, for Spider-Man. She can actually bring him back from the brink. And when she does it in this issue, it was one of my favorite moments that I've ever read from any Spider-Man comic.
She does give a nice little pep talk.
Yeah, she brings him back and reminds him of, you know, why you don't quit and how she's no quitter either, how she's determined to beat this this ailment that has confined her to a wheelchair for a while, but now she's getting up and walking because she's determined not to be stuck there for the rest of her life. And in that moment, you start to see Peter battling back, saying, you know what, if my aunt, who has been through all this, can battle back, then
by God, I can battle back. I can get back in this. I'm not done yet. And that it's one of those great, just classic hero moments. And Steve Ditko draws the absolute ever-living hell out of it. So, yeah, this, as much as I love seeing J. Jonah Jameson smiling like the cat who swallowed the canary, and he does throughout this entire issue, he has the biggest shit-eating grin you have ever seen on any person's face ever. Yet he still manages to be an old miser about money throughout the entire thing, but he does it with a big smile on his face, like he's being generous, sending a get well card, but making sure you leave the envelope unsealed because you can send it for a penny cheaper. That's J. Jonah Jameson, folks. That is the classic bastard that we have all come to know and love. And I cannot wait to see the look on his face when he realizes that he did not actually take Spider-Man down, that in fact Spider-Man is back. And whenever that happens, I am ready to see my old, fun, curmudgeon J. Jonah Jameson next time around. Bravo on Amazing Spider-Man 18. This is just a tremendous, tremendous issue. And yeah, this one of the best runs on this character that's ever been. His original creators really just got him in a way that made him almost a fully formed character right from the jump. This is good shit.
Absolutely. I agree wholeheartedly. So I think we have blown this issue to hell at this point. Yep. So let's move on to the final two entries on our reading list. And mercifully, they were pretty short because we get two little, I think it's 10-page Doctor Strange stories in Strange Tales 126 and 127. And this features Doctor Strange being sent in to the dark realm where dwells the dread Dormammu by the Ancient One. And from a plot standpoint, pretty straightforward here, but it gives Steve Ditko the opportunity to really cut loose. Pretty much once Doc Strange is in the dark realm, getting to see that imagery and getting to see the introduction of the Mindless Ones and that concept, it's Ditko at his best. Like, Amazing Spider-Man is great, don't get me wrong, but you can tell that Steve Ditko loves drawing this Doctor Strange stuff. I don't know what else to say about it. Todd, does this continue the Doc Strange momentum in your eyes?
It does. God bless the Doctor Strange movie, so I know how to say Dormammu. pretty worthy adversary, and worth the price of admission just to see Steve Ditko draw these other dimensional figures, these other dimensional ideas, and get to explore things. Steve Ditko cannot, however, design female hairstyles one leg. Because you get the character, introduction of the character Klee, and it doesn't quite work. Her hair looks like, the words fail me, how ridiculous it would look in real life. But still, more of the same. You get lots of Ancient One action and more development, and you find out that Doctor Strange is destined for greater things. To be the heir of the Ancient One. Great art, very good story, especially considering the page limitations, and Doctor Strange is interacting with, they're building up his rogues gallery and his supporting cast. So good stuff, continuation of the momentum of Doctor Strange, like you said.
Yep. Russell, you were pretty blown away last episode by the Doc Strange stuff, much like I think we all were. Little snippet here, but did this continue the momentum for you?
It absolutely did. As Todd said, this is really straightforward kind of superhero stuff for a Doc Strange book. So it's not going in the noir magical detective direction that I kind of hoped for, that was alluded to in Doctor Strange's very first appearance. But seeing the first appearance of Dormammu and having the Dark Realm kind of established a bit more, or established in the first place here, and of course, as Todd said, that showing us that Doctor Strange is indeed bound for bigger things, we also get the debut of the Mindless Ones, who will be playing a larger part with Doctor Strange later on in his history. So there's there's lots of stuff happening here in this very like very short amount of time. And honestly, you could take the these two short stories, combine them together, and you'd have a whole issue. So mm-hmm. I think we're on the verge. We are definitely on the verge of Doctor Strange having his own title, moving out of this this anthology business, because it really does feel like, you know, people are on board with his character. They're really digging him. I'm digging the hell out of him. So yeah, we're moving in the right direction. I knew how to say Dormammu correctly, thanks to the Spider-Man animated series from the 1990s, because they had Doctor Strange and introduced the whole like mythos of Doctor Strange within that show as well. Lots of good stuff here. We also are we talking about both of the issues now?
Yeah, we're just gonna
might as well. Okay,
it's one story.
It is all totally one story, and we've had Doctor Strange in the blue cape up to now, and at the end of this story, he gets some new wares from the Ancient One, who has seen his student kind of graduate up to that next level. So you get the red cape and a new, I guess it's a new charm that he's going to be wearing around his neck too. So lots of good stuff here. One that I really enjoyed reading. I can't believe how much I'm enjoying Doctor Strange. It's something that I never thought that I would say, but it continues to be what I was hoping for, mostly what I was hoping for out of reading this character, and more, and even a little bit of complexity with the moral dilemma that Doctor Strange finds himself in with the Mindless Ones being held at bay by Dormammu. Who, while he may plan to invade Earth and take it over, if not for him, this other realm that he inhabits and rules would have been destroyed and all these people killed by the Mindless Ones. And at one point, Doctor Strange kind of makes a pretty morally ambiguous choice. It's kind of a Sophie's choice, really, but it's one that shows the complexity of the character and makes him far more interesting than I probably ever expected him to be. So yeah, this is another strong showing for Doctor Strange.
Absolutely. Tim?
Yeah, there's something to this idea that perhaps Stan Lee had about American interventionist policy, you know, that's being explored in this conflict between Doctor Strange and Dormammu, where he is ostensibly showing up here in the Dark Dimension to take out Dormammu before he can invade Earth, but then comes to realize, well, Dormammu is keeping this bigger threat to his own people in check. And while I disagree with him greatly and find him to be a repugnant individual, he is kind of doing right by his own people that also inhabit the Dark Dimension, who we meet one of. Not exactly sure who these Mindless Ones might represent.
Dark Passengers.
Yes, very good. I mean, I was really waiting for the line here in one of these issues of Dormammu, I've come to bargain. just never happened. That's very much what he's doing here, right? That's how he resolves this thing. But yeah, good stuff from Ditko as well. I like that the Dark Realm is depicted as, it's almost like, I don't know, exploring a Salvador Dali painting, you know?
Yeah.
It's just so trippy. So really solid stuff there. Did you guys happen to read the first half of these Strange Tales? Okay.
Nope, hard pass.
Gotcha. It's basically just the Fantastic Four B-list title.
It's like a hard Marvel pass. 2-in-1 kind of preview or you know, the thing in Johnny. I did read one of these with Ben and Johnny, and that was fine, but it was kind of filler too at the same point. But it was the best parts of the Fantastic Four in a story. So that was cool.
Mm-hmm. I did notice that the last one, I flipped through it real quick, had a heel Reed Richards. So, you know, that was cool for me.
It's utterly absurd.
Yeah.
Well, shit. Now I got to go back and reread it because that's the only Reed Richards I will like.
Just testing you out. Reed Richards always sounds like smart Vince McMahon or Vince McMahon with the Brett screwed Brett. That's what I use for the Reed, my Reed voice now. Headcanon.
Awesome. Well, without all that being said, that brings an end to our reading list. Once again, we have provided you with a Peter Jackson-like show. And just because the reading list is over, it means that in true Peter Jackson fashion, we got to hit you with like four more endings. So real quick, before we wrap up the show, we're going to go through our year-end awards like we always do. And once again, no point at all in doing a Writer of the Year award. Stan Lee is still writing everything, literally everything. So Stan is by default the Writer of the Year, and it is well-deserved for his massive output at this point. So let's jump over to Artist of the Year, and I will go first here. It is ultra close. Like I have, you know, last year I said that I kind of preferred Ditko by a pretty comfortable margin. This year, by the narrowest of margins, I'm actually going to give it to Jack Kirby, and I'm going to give it to him largely on the back of Fantastic Four 25 and 26, where he draws, for my money anyway, the best damn action scene we've seen thus far in 3 years of Marvel publishing. That Thing and Hulk fight, that Hulk versus the Fantastic Four and Avengers extended run, where it's just like nonstop action for the majority of two issues. Outstanding. Haven't seen anything better from Jack Kirby. I'm going to give it to him for 1964. What about you, Russell?
God, this is this is a real, this is the toughest choice I've had to make yet on this show. Because I'm struggling here. Even in this very moment, I'm bouncing it back and forth because damn, you're absolutely right about Kirby on that Fantastic Four 25 and 26. What a tour de force that is, and his sheer output on the other books as well. Like he's become, you know, he's Master Kirby as we have seen, but I can't do it. I gotta go Ditko. I gotta give it to Steve Ditko. It's by the narrowest of margins though, but it's all in the Amazing Spider-Man work because it is just mind-blowingly good. He might have had like one kind of issue in there with the Green Goblin's first appearance, but it was still pretty good. But that annual, that Amazing Spider-Man annual, and then issue 18 right after it, these are two of the absolute best-looking comics ever. And those pages of Spider-Man hitting the Sinister Six in the face, taking them each out individually. Just nope, can't do it. I can't give it to anybody else. Steve Ditko, you are still the man. You're still my guy when it comes to this Silver Age era. Steve Ditko is just where it's at for my money. I will throw all my money at him to keep getting more of it. So that's it. That's it for me. Steve Ditko wins.
Outstanding. Todd, what about you?
Kirby by the narrowest of margins, just because the breadth of his work. I saw cool, iconic things in X-Men, Avengers, Fantastic Four, and Journey into Mystery. Still right. Enjoyed lots of great stuff from Steve Ditko. Also enjoyed the individual issues from Bill Everett and Joe Orlando, but Kirby is my winner for 64. Done.
Absolutely. What about you, Tim?
Well said, Todd and Nick. I am going to have to agree on Kirby, especially for FF 25-26, what felt like a true epic. And as Todd was saying, you know, that on the strength of that story alone, I'd probably give it to him, but then you've got the solid X-Men stuff, and even really great work on Avengers. Thor, always a standout. So it's a pretty easy choice for me this year in going Kirby.
Well, and covers, too. I mean, he still did Daredevil covers, even though that wasn't his book. And, you know, that Captain America Avengers 4 cover is one of the greatest of all time.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. Let's move over to our villain of the year. And this one, you had a lot of contenders here, but for me, that Fantastic Four annual number two, like I said earlier, just kind of, it marks the emergence of the true Dr. Doom that we all know to this day. And so for me, based off of that, I'm giving it to Dr. Doom. What about you, Tim?
I almost want to go the Hulk.
You know, that's a great point. Yeah.
Unconventional pick, but no, I think I will agree with you on Dr. Doom. He got a lot of good material this year.
What about you, Todd?
Same. Although I voted for him last year too, just because he's my favorite and he had developed just a little bit. This year, you got to see the real good stuff. So Dr. Doom, mm-hmm. Greatest villain in the history of the Marvel Universe, and you got to see really why in 1964.
Yeah. Russell?
Call it a clean sweep. Dr. Doom wins.
Yeah, absolutely. Doom, but I like Tim's idea. I didn't even think about the Hulk, but that was a good call, Tim. What about our hero of the year? For me, once again, nothing else like him in terms of relatability and character development. Peter Parker takes it in a landslide. I'm going Spider-Man. What about you, Russell?
Same. No contest here, really, for me. Spider-Man is your hands-down winner, top to bottom, easy victory. Takes it in a walk.
Todd?
Rick, Spider-Man. Spider-Man is
Man of the Jimmy.
Come on. Especially because every other compelling book other than Doctor Strange to me, and maybe Journey into Mystery is a team book. Spider-Man is the man himself, all issue, every issue, and nothing else was like it at the time. Changed comics forever. He's the hero of 64. Peter Parker, Spider-Man.
If you could give it to a team, like consider you give it to Spider-Man or the Fantastic Four as a whole, would that change your opinion?
It would be close. I mean, it'd be a narrower margin, but I'd still go Spider-Man just because, yes, we'd never seen anything like either to this point in comics, and I wasn't there, believe it or not. But
liar,
it's true. Still, both the things that made them unique, the things that were relatable and more compelling. I think Spider-Man holds up just a little bit more. It's a little bit more universal. It has not changed with the times as much as the family dynamic you would see in Fantastic Four. The concept is more timeless and relatable.
I agree. What about you, Tim? Your hero or heroes of the year?
I'm going to have to go with heroic yet rebellious Flash Thompson.
In costume in ASM 18. That was a great moment we didn't talk about.
Yep.
Exactly.
That was good shit.
It's not too often you can have a genuine hero moment from a character being inspired from a little speech by his 900,000-year-old relative, and then just picking up his costume out of the trash. This is not exactly Spider-Man, you know, lifting heavy machinery type of thing, and yet it still packs a punch, that little moment in ASM 18. So, I mean, that's one of many that Spider-Man gets this year. So I really got to give it to him as a good solo hero showcase. Easily my hero of the year, Spider-Man.
Nice. Let's wrap it up with, for me, what was the toughest call of this year, our issue of the year. And it was so difficult. I actually have something different written down in my notes that I was going to go with, but I'm going to make a last minute. I'm going to swap it. And just because this book was so wildly different from anything else that was being published in comics in general at this point, because it speaks to storytelling sensibilities that I still love to this day, I am going to go Amazing Spider-Man 18 as my issue of the year. Nothing else like it. Completely unique. An exploration of Peter Parker with very little regard, honestly, for Spider-Man. It's remarkable. Just so, so different. What about you, Tim?
You know, I want to count FF 25 and 26 because sure. It's one story. Okay. If you didn't allow it, I would go 26 still.
FF 25, in full disclosure, was the one I had written down to go with as my number one.
Okay.
Like, loved it that much.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I never thought I'd really be saying this about a Fantastic Four comic, but that story is such a page turner to me. It made me want to read more FF this year, which is something that almost never happens. Even when, you know, there are genuinely good issues, this was gripping to me. It truly was. It felt absolutely enormous, this conflict. The characterizations were all really on point. You, of course, get the first meeting between the FF and the Avengers, which goes somewhat badly, in fact. So part of that is just really a good example of how these two teams bouncing off of each other and that dynamic and that conflict was what set Marvel apart from its distinguished competition. So, you know, there's so much going on in this story. Well worth your time to check out. And this was an easy pick for me, really, as my top story. While we did encounter a lot of good stuff, this one I really had as far and away sitting above all the others.
Absolutely. Todd, I know which way you're going, but go ahead and make it official.
You know, I had said the annual was my favorite of the year. I think it's almost going to be a three-way tie. I'm going to still give the nod, I think, to the annual, but the issue 18 of Amazing Spider-Man and we have to look at the whole big picture. And Avengers number 4 changed everything and gave it turned that book around. If you look at the very, very big picture, Avengers might have kind of died off by issue 10 without Captain America. So I'm with all three of those with a slight nod to the annual, just because I love annuals, the value you get for one. If I was going to take one book and be on a desert island and derive the pleasure from it by reading it over and over, cover to cover, I could look at those pinups all day. I could look at the splash pages culminating in those of those battles between Spidey and the Sinister Six all day. So it's a tough call. I think there are no wrong answers of the ones we've talked about. But Amazing Spider-Man, annual number one. And I do want to say, Marvel Unlimited makes it a little confusing to find that particular issue. If you're looking for Amazing Spider-Man, you have to look under The Amazing Spider-Man, and you get the classic series from 62. If you're looking at, is it 62 or 63? I think it started in 63. If you're looking at the annuals, it's listed as Amazing. So it's very nitpicky, but you have the Amazing Spider-Man and then Amazing Spider-Man annuals. And were Ben Morse still working there, he could have fixed it for us, but he's not. So it's kind of a pain. So if you're looking for them, Amazing Spider-Man, the series is listed under The Amazing Spider-Man, but the annuals are not.
Absolutely. Russell, your issue of the year.
I'll go ahead and say it. Amazing Spider-Man 18. Mm-hmm. It's the one. You guys have said it. Perfect, Bubba. I don't think I can adequately add anything to that. Although I will say that I agree with Todd that the annual number one, Amazing Spider-Man annual number one, was a damn close second there. But another one that I did consider for a moment, X-Men number 4.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed seeing this marked turnaround in the X-Men books. And because I love that team. And if we were picking teams of the year, X-Men wins for me, because this book has really become much more of what I had hoped to see out of it. So, Amazing Spider-Man 18, big winner this year, big pop for me. And it's one that I could see myself enjoying over and over again. Incredibly influential issue. And lots of writers and artists, you can tell, pull from it as Spider-Man's history continues. So big, big winner for this one.
Absolutely. Glad to hear that. Great picks all around from everyone. Great thoughts. And with that, people, it mercifully brings an end to this issue or this episode of Marvel Age. If you've stuck with us this long, we thank you so much. We have really enjoyed hearing all the feedback from people. We've enjoyed seeing people following along, reading along with us. So real quick before we get out of here, I'm going to give everybody an opportunity to plug what else they have going on for Place to Be Nation and tell them where you can find them on social media. For me, of course, I'm here with Marvel Age. I am also over at the Hard Traveling Fanboys, who are
the longest running podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
You know the words. Anyway, the point being, you can find me at Nick2K87. You can listen to those podcasts. We are torturing ourselves for this upcoming episode you're going to hear pretty soon, featuring The Amazing Spider-Man 2. Look back at that atrocious film. So, Tim, what about you? What you got going on, and where can people interact with you?
Okay, also on Place to Be Nation, with the wonderful, as always, Jennifer Smith, we host the talk show of Place Me Nation Pup, and that is Talkin' Pop. So our June episode coming out around middle part of the month, we're going to have Steve Willey as our guest. So he'll be in the very hot seat. Should be a good time with him. On Place to Be Nation Wrestling, I have, survey says, a WCW retrospective with my co-host Andy Helene, looking back at all the great personalities, events, concepts, what have you, from World Championship Wrestling, kind of doing a summer month for the next few months here on that program. Again, look for that episode, our June episode, to drop a little bit later this month. On social media, hit me up on Twitter. I am at Psyche68, that's Cyke68. And that's all I got to say about that.
Russell, what about you?
Well, Marvel Age is really the main place you're going to be finding me for a little while, but you can also catch the final pod blast that I and the illustrious Todd Weber just wrapped up our pod blast series on Dark Knight's Metal, where we also broke down the four-issue miniseries of Justice League No Justice and its status quo shifting events for the Scott Snyder, Jim Chung, and Jorge Jimenez Justice League title. So you guys go check that out. It was a lot of fun to do that with Todd. Maybe we'll do another similar thing in the future sometime. You can, as Nick mentioned, there's some Amazing Spider-Man 2 talk coming up where I will be joining in on that shit show, as it were. And then later on, maybe I'll get to talk with those guys on the Hard Traveling Fanboys about some better Spider-Man down the road. But Sellers Points will be coming back. I don't know if it's going to come back in June or not, but there's a new special project that I'm going to be doing with that. And as soon as I have all those ducks in a row, the Sellers Points podcast will return. Until then, on social media, you can find me at Russell_Sellers on Twitter. Join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. I'm in there chatting comics with folks. Would love to hear feedback from everybody on all the stuff that we've done. So search for that on Facebook. Jump on in and have a good time with us.
Absolutely. Todd, what about you?
On Twitter, at Todd Weber Guitar. Check out this newest episode following this one by about a week. You will find me on the latest episode of Marvel Age Masterclass, the companion show to this podcast. I also produce and edit 80% of the content on Place to Be Nation Pop feed, found on iTunes or Stitcher. Check out placetobenation.com, your only home, no, the only home, whatever it is, in your pop culture world.
the only place to be in
this pop culture world.
It's late. We're tired.
Yeah, yep. We're punchy.
Oh, man. So well said, Todd. And with that, guys, thanks for listening. Go back and listen to the other episodes of Marvel Age. Go listen to Marvel Age Masterclass. Check out all the other great shows on Place to Be Nation Pop. And until next time,
wait, wait,
I have
wait, If you're listening to this show and you don't subscribe to Marvel Unlimited, what the fuck is wrong with you?
That's
really
right.
Really? What's your problem?
How can you
subscribe
how can you follow along with us if you're not?
All right, that's all I got to say.
Do the annual subscription. It's a better value. You know, you're not going to see deductions month after month. Just
now that we have successfully cursed out our listeners, thanks for listening. We hope you'll come back at some point for more of that. Thank you.
Forbidden kingdom of Latveria. Herein dwells the most powerful, the most mysterious monarch in all the world. Guarded by a fighting force that never sleeps, that never relaxes its vigilance. For none is as feared, none has as many foes as Dr. Doom, the awesome armor-clad Lord of Latveria.
The Fantastic Four. The time has come for them to meet their master. Little do they dream that soon they shall be serving Dr. Doom. And after them, the world itself shall lie helpless at my feet. Now, all that remains is to meet my victims face to face.